Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Hitler had the supreme fascist state. And what was he worried about in Europe and in Germany? He was worried about white genetic annihilation. What is everybody in Europe worried about now? White genetic annihilation. All these people from Syria coming up in here.
Police in Germany are reporting a rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes. The German government wants answers. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Berlin.
Monty Oates is a young Jewish LGBT activist in Berlin. On his walk home from work, he told me about what's happened to him while wearing a Jewish head covering, a kippah.
I've seen people spitting out in front of me because I was wearing a kippah, people shouting at me, Jew, in the middle of the streets, in the center of the city. And if I tell people about things I experience, they say, what, this happened to you? I didn't even know that there is anti-Semitism today in Germany.
There is some disagreement about the nature of anti-Semitism in Germany today. For example, when does criticism of Israel cross into anti-Jewish expression? And whether far-right anti-Semitism or anti-Semitism from Muslims is the bigger problem.
There have been problems with rising anti-Semitism amongst the Muslim community, most of whom are of migrant background, going back several generations now, for many years.
Deidre Berger heads the American Jewish Committee in Berlin. The group surveyed Berlin school teachers who reported some students crossing out Israel from maps and expressing fundamentalist Muslim ideologies. Her group is helping teachers develop lesson plans to address the issue with students. Dervish Hisarjeh, another Berlin activist, addresses a seminar of high school counselors about how to identify anti-Semitism. He's Muslim, and he says some Muslims in Germany go on the defensive when they're accused of anti-Semitism. They see it as part of a campaign of Islamophobia, fueled by Germany's growing far right.
We are searching for ways how we can win people to be aware of problems such as anti-Semitism, and how can we communicate this issue to them so that they take responsibility and not deny it.
Last year, Germany appointed its first national commissioner to combat anti-Semitism, Felix Klein. He told me his focus right now is to collect data. Police say anti-Semitic crimes rose 10% last year, with 90% of the attacks coming from the far right. But there's a dispute about some of the figures.
If you talk to the Jews in this country, they perceive attacks emanating from Muslims, from radical Muslims, of course, as much higher. They think it's around 40% when it comes also to physical attacks.
Klein hopes to clear this up with a nationwide online reporting portal launched last month for Germans to report behavior they witness that's not officially criminal, but is still anti-Semitic, like graffiti or bullying in schools. He hopes by the end of the year to have enough examples to draw some conclusions.
Because then we know more about the perpetrators, about the social backgrounds maybe where anti-Semitic incidents do appear. And that, of course, will constitute a very, very important piece of information for our strategies for preventing anti-Semitism.
Some Jews say they face lots of skepticism about their complaints, and they hope Klein's statistics will highlight the extent of anti-Semitism in Germany today. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Berlin.
Canada. We should move to Canada.
Today, I would like to underscore one of the most serious terrorist threats of the current age, white supremacism.
Are among the gravest terrorist threats that the world is facing today. We were all reminded of this tragic reality on the 15th of March, when a white supremacist terrorist killed 50 Muslims gathered in two mosques for Friday prayers in Christchurch, New Zealand. As a Canadian, this attack was all too familiar. 2 years ago, a terrorist killed six people in a Quebec City mosque. Neo-Nazis, white supremacists, incels, nativists, and radical anti-globalists who resort to violent acts are a threat to the stability of my country and countries around the world. These attacks need to be at the top of our agenda when we talk about confronting terrorism. And when violence like this occurs in mosques, churches, synagogues, or on the streets of our major cities, we must not be afraid to specifically condemn it for what it is: neo-Nazism, white supremacism, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, terrorism. We can't hide behind euphemisms that distract from the truth. In fact, doing so puts our citizens, especially those from religious minorities and racialized communities, in greater danger. In the wake of acts of terrorism carried out by Muslim extremists, Western countries often call upon Muslim countries and Muslim leaders to condemn those attacks in the name of their people and their faith. It should follow that, as the foreign minister of a majority white and majority Christian country, I feel a specific and personal responsibility to denounce white supremacist attacks in the same way. As my Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said in our House of Commons following the Christchurch attack, when we fail to denounce hatred with total conviction, we empower those people and legitimize their violence. Hatred, unfortunately, is eternal. But the ways in which it spreads change. Today, hatred is increasingly spread through the internet, in online forums, and on social media. We must be aware of this and work to stop it. Our work cannot be undertaken in isolation. Each of our countries will, of course, address this issue in different ways, but we need to recognize that this is ultimately an international problem, and we need to act collectively to address it. The internet and social media know no borders, and so we must work together to find ways to address online radicalization. And on a final note, I would like to offer, on behalf of Canada and Canadians, our support and compassion for the people of New Zealand. As fellow members of the Commonwealth, Canada and New Zealand have a close and historic relationship. We're more than friends, we are family. And Canadians felt great compassion and real pain following the terrible attacks in Christchurch. In particular, I'd like to salute the moral leadership of Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who has distinguished herself not only to the people of New Zealand, but to the whole world. Thank you. Merci.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause, and you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
We'll begin today with a major new policy shift, not from the government, but from Facebook. The social media giant has announced that it is banning content related to white nationalism and white separatism on its platform as part of its response to how Facebook was used by the New Zealand mosque murderer. According to a statement from the company, an existing prohibition on posts declaring white supremacy is now expanded to include white nationalist and white separatist content as well, and directing users who appear to be posting or looking for that kind of thing to a group called Life After Hate, that Facebook says uses crisis intervention techniques and other things to try to counsel people out of white supremacist ideology. Let's find out more about this and discuss the issues it raises with Jason Kebler, editor-in-chief for the Vice News tech site Motherboard. They actually broke this story about the Facebook change in policy before Facebook announced it. We'll also touch briefly on another breaking Facebook story this morning that Jason noted on Twitter today. The federal government is apparently charging Facebook with housing discrimination over the company's targeted advertising practices. Jason, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Do you understand how Facebook defines white nationalism and white separatism, or how it intends to ban them?
Yeah, so Facebook defines white nationalism as very explicitly someone saying, I am a white nationalist or I am a white separatist. You know, I believe that whites should have their own nation, things like that. It has banned white supremacism for quite some time, but Facebook drew a specific distinction between white supremacy, white nationalism, and white separatism for a few years. We learned this with our reporting, a big feature that we did last year. And once we published that article, you talk to, you know, black history scholars, you talk to academics, you talk to really anyone who studied the history of hate in the United States and worldwide, and they say that there is no distinction between these ideologies. So Facebook has now decided that they agree with sort of the dominant thinking there, that there is no difference, and they will treat them all the same.
Do you know what Facebook's thinking had been up until now? I see the statement that they posted said it already had long banned hateful treatment of people based on things like race, ethnicity, or religion, but that data analysis of their users has shown them the overlap between white supremacy, white nationalism, and white separatism. Do you understand how they used to distinguish between those things in the past until Tuesday?
I do, because we have leaked documents that they were basically training slides that were given to moderators around the world about how they should enforce this sort of thing. And Facebook lays this out very clearly. It's very weird to see it sort of like on a PowerPoint. But what Facebook said is that white nationalism and white separatism can be, quote, inclusive. That is not inherently hateful. You know, it's a class of people, in this case, white people, advocating for something and not advocating against something, which is it's kind of ridiculous, but it's also where they drew the line. They
certainly
said,
not inclusive to be a separatist.
Right. But they're saying, you know, a white nation would include white people, and therefore it could be a positive, not inherently hateful thing. That is no longer their policy, but that was their policy for years.
I see. So your article on Motherboard seems to suggest, and what you said a minute ago, is that they'll only ban explicit white nationalist kinds of statements, like I am a proud white nationalist is one example, or immigration is tearing this country apart, white separatism is the only answer is another example you give. Is that from their site? Were those examples provided by Facebook?
Those were examples provided by Facebook to us. You know, when we talked to them on the record, we asked, you know, can you give us examples of things that you are going to ban? And from what I understand, this is based on actual things that Facebook has seen on its site. You know, they considered other options. One option that they considered was, you know, we'll ban white nationalism and white separatism, but only if it includes an attack on, you know, a protected class. So, you know, I think that black people should be excluded or something from a white nation. But then Facebook looked at its platform and saw that people weren't actually posting that way. What they said was that nationalism and separatism had become, in a sense, a coded version of supremacy, because people would say, I'm not a racist. I'm proud to be a white nationalist. And yeah, that's what.
And they used to think that distinction was real, but then they noted it was becoming more of a thing during their white supremacy ban, and I guess they decided it was phony or a dodge. But we know that many white separatist or nationalist or supremacist sentiments aren't expressed as directly as those examples. So has Facebook said where they'll draw the line?
They have not said explicitly where they will draw the line, but for the moment, the policy is explicit white nationalism and explicit white separatism is not allowed. They acknowledge that implicit white separatism and nationalism is a problem, but, you know, frankly, they said It's too hard for us to detect at scale. It's too hard for us to remove. Facebook has more than 2 billion users worldwide. This is a problem not only in the United States. It's a problem in Eastern Europe. It's a problem, obviously, in Australia and New Zealand and other places as well. So they need to make sure that their policies are enforced in the same way in New Zealand as they are in the United States, as they are in Eastern Europe. And they're concerned that if it's left up to sort of a judgment call, that it will lead to inconsistent enforcement. That's their argument. I don't know that I agree with it, but mm-hmm. that's what they say.
Yeah. And I mean, by this standard, with things that Steve Bannon has said, like he's not a white nationalist, he's an economic nationalist, trying to make that distinction, which some people believe is a dodge, be considered white supremacy, or the Tucker Carlson quote that emerged recently, the Fox host who said, and I don't know the exact quote, but I think I'm paraphrasing it, credibly, white men invented civilization and stuff. I think that was the quote.
Yeah. So Facebook realizes that this is going to be politically contentious. This is, you know, it came up in my conversation with them. They have been accused of anti-conservative bias in the past. They also told us that they consulted with external experts on this, and not all of them agreed that Facebook should ban white nationalism and white separatism. Presumably, the people who did not agree were conservative groups. And it's something that they are thinking about because there are, you know, politicians both in the United States and in Eastern Europe who veer very close to white nationalism and separatism, and they have huge platforms. And Facebook doesn't want to be seen as censoring speech, but at the same time, they don't want to be seen as a platform where people can post hate and then go on killings like we've seen in New Zealand and in the United States as well.
And yes, they are under pressure from both sides. They're certainly under pressure from, as they say, civil rights and civil society groups to do the kinds of things they just did this week. On the other side, I could have pulled a Donald Trump clip from just a week or two ago where he said something to the effect that the social media sites are banning speech and it's always conservatives, or removing people and it's always conservatives.
Yeah, and it's not. I mean, we did a huge feature on this. I think it was like 9,000 words. It's the longest thing Motherboard has ever published. We worked on it for months. We went to Facebook and talked to their policy team. This is a team that's made up of dozens and dozens of people. Many of them used to work, you know, in policy teams in Congress, or they're lawyers, civil rights experts. And if anything, I feel like they are very concerned about their perception among conservatives, because conservatives have been so outspoken, worried that Facebook is banning their speech. But, you know, the case has been thus far, what we've seen is that white nationalism and white separatism has been tied to violent acts offline. And Facebook is very worried about, you know, speech online moving offline and then them getting blamed for hosting that sort of content. You don't necessarily see that with you know, other types of speech that haven't been banned.
Listeners, if you're just joining us, my guest is Jason Kebler, editor-in-chief of the Vice News tech site Motherboard, as we talk about Facebook's announcement that it is banning content related to white nationalism and white separatism on its platform. It already banned content, at least it said it did, relating to white supremacy. It used to make that distinction between white supremacy versus white nationalism and separatism. It will no longer make that distinction, and it will refer people looking for that kind of content to a group called Life After Hate, which tries to counsel people out of white supremacist views. Mark Zuckerberg has evolved on this, I guess. I pulled a few clips from the commencement speech that he gave at Harvard in May 2017. Now, people will remember he went to Harvard. That's where Facebook got invented, and from where he dropped out to become more serious about working on the company full time.
If I get through this speech today, it'll be the first time I actually finish something here at Harvard.
So there was that. But then he went on to say this.
This is the struggle of our time. The forces of freedom, openness, and global community against the forces of authoritarianism, isolationism, and nationalism. Forces for the flow of knowledge, trade, and immigration against those who would slow them down. This is not a battle of nations. It is a battle of ideas.
It's a battle of ideas. It's a fairly tame way to put it. And then he also said this. Now, this was just weeks before Charlottesville and Trump's good people on both sides comment.
There are people in every country for more global connection, and there are good people against it. And this isn't going to be decided at the UN either. It's going to happen at the local level when enough of us feel a sense of purpose and stability in our own lives that we can start to open up and care about everyone else too. And the best way to do that is to start building local communities right now.
Mark Zuckerberg in his Harvard commencement speech in May 2017. Jason Kebler from Vice News' tech site Motherboard with us. Jason, a few things in that clip struck me.
That's the most intense I've ever heard Mark Zuckerberg.
You know, for one thing, there are people in every country for global connection and good people against it. You know, good people on both sides. Of course, when he talks about global connection, that's a very gentle way of describing what the divide is about. I wonder if at that point he was even thinking in terms of white supremacy and the overlap between those things.
Yeah, given what Facebook's previous policy is, I believe that Facebook didn't consult with enough people or think deeply enough about this issue. I got the sense that the people who are making this policy do care a lot about drawing the correct balance between free speech and not allowing hate on their website. But at the same time, you know, the scholarship around white nationalism, white separatism, and white supremacy, it's not a new thing. It's not a new thing that, you know, white nationalism is tied to white supremacy. You know, dating back decades, white supremacists have used this idea of white nationalism or white separatism to sort of whitewash the idea of white separatism. They say, or white supremacy, they say that they are not supremacists, they are nationalists. I think in, you know, that speech from Mark Zuckerberg, he may have been speaking more toward Facebook's attempt to build this sort of global community.
He was.
And I think that this is a very important thing to realize when you think about Facebook, is that when they make the rules for Facebook, they are trying to make one set of global rules that apply to everyone across the entire world. And they often don't think about, you know, individual countries' histories and individual cultures. You know, when they say, when they allowed this white nationalism, white separatism distinction, one thing that they said is that they needed to allow for separatist movements in places like the Basque Country in France and Spain, and black separatist movements in Africa and the United States as well. And that if they, you know, made a separate distinction for white nationalism, white separatism, it'd be difficult to enforce. And they were worried that they'd be seen as discriminating against white people. And I think that they realize now that white separatism is different from these other movements because it's been tied so closely to violence.
And the other thing that struck me in that clip when he said this isn't going to be decided at the UN either. It's going to happen at the local level. And in a way, he's acknowledging that Facebook is the UN today, right? It's not if he landed in that clip on it's going to get better when enough of us feel a sense of purpose and stability in our own lives, he said, that we can open up and start caring about everyone. The best way to do that is to start building local communities right now. That struck me as, don't look at Facebook for this, which is a global community, right? A place where people from all over the world can come together on the same platform, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. He seemed to be deflecting attention from Facebook and now kind of acknowledging that in a way they are a giant public utility that the whole world can use.
He did, but I mean, at the same time, he is the UN and he is making these decisions. I mean, maybe not on an individual level, but, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, the COO of Facebook, was very involved in this decision to ban white nationalism and white separatism. You know, Mark Zuckerberg has been on record defending Holocaust denial on the platform, or defending the right of Holocaust deniers to use his platform for that reason. And, you know, the fact is Facebook has a lot of power to make these decisions, and it's affecting the speech of 2 billion people. There are no countries that are that large. I mean, Facebook has more power than any country on earth to regulate the speech of its users. I think Zuckerberg has talked very loftily about what his vision is for the future of content moderation, and it does get to this idea of local communities, and what he envisions is a different set of rules for every user, one that is sort of governed by AI and machine learning. So if you don't want to see this sort of content, then it won't be surfaced to you. But if someone else does, then, you know, they will be allowed to see it, and that will be all automated. He wrote this very long, you know, treatise about it, I think, a year and a half ago. And
that's how sometimes violent white nationalist extremists or ISIS-related extremists use social media to recruit, right? People who can find references that are of interest to them that are less direct than "I am a proud white nationalist" or that kind of thing. I mean, look at the New Zealand killer. In the manifesto that he posted, he used all kinds of white nationalist in-crowd references that many people wouldn't get, like referring to a certain alt-right social media star and other things like that.
Yeah, I mean, the rise of these violent attacks online, I think, you know, they're tied to a lot of different things. But it used to be that if you were a white nationalist and you were in the middle of a rural area or something, you would have to find other people in your local area to, you know, talk about being a white nationalist. Now you can log on to 8chan. You used to be able to log on to Facebook. You used to be able to log on to Twitter and find a bunch of people who agree with you and to espouse those views together. So I think that the internet has had a huge effect on the resurgence of these ideologies and, in some way, the normalization of them.
Jeanette in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeanette.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I'm just wondering if there's a certain rationale to limit white supremacists and not black supremacists or black nationalists or any other group. Once you start limiting one group's views about the others, why limit just that group's? I mean, there was a time when Martin Luther King was battling with other black groups who were not nonviolent, as his was. There were many black groups at that time that were quite violent. Are you going to limit just white nationalists and other groups?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important question. It's one that Facebook has grappled with for years now. Their rationale at the moment is that white nationalism is tied to violence offline in a way that other nationalist movements are not. And specifically, if you look at something like the Basque movement, there are arms of the Basque movement that are violent, but they're very much tied to specific groups in the same way that ISIS is a group or Al-Qaeda is a group. White nationalism, of course, there are white nationalist terrorist groups, but there's a lot more sort of lone wolf terrorists or lone wolf shooters who are inspired by this ideology online and then go and shoot up a mosque or a church, and they are not tied to any group. They're only tied to this loose idea of white nationalism and that rhetoric that's online.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
If you've peeked at cable news today, you might have gotten whiplash from the latest twist in an already strange case. Prosecutors in Chicago dropped all charges against TV actor Jussie Smollett. Smollett, who is black and gay, had been accused of orchestrating a hate crime on himself. He was indicted last month for filing a false police report to that effect. WBEZ's Miles Bryan joins us now from Chicago. And Miles, let's just start with prosecutors. Did anyone have any sense that it would turn out this way?
No, we did not see this coming. So in the last major update to this case, Cook County prosecutors, they laid out this detailed roadmap of evidence that they said they planned to use to show that Smollett staged a hate crime with the help of two brothers he knew as part of a ploy to increase his salary on the show Empire. But this morning, the media got a mysterious emergency message from Smollett's PR person, and so we all raced over to the courthouse to find out that the prosecutors were dropping all charges. Smollett's legal team said that this was a full exoneration. He spoke to the press.
I've been truthful and consistent on every single level since day one. I would not be my mother's son if I was capable of one drop of what I have been accused of.
So in that press conference, he's maintaining his innocence. But does that actually mean prosecutors are saying that they were wrong to bring charges against him in the first place?
No, definitely not, which is a bit confusing. So the Cook County prosecutors say they stand behind the police's investigation into the case and their decision to charge him. They say they struck a deal with Smollett called an alternative prosecution. It's something they do for nonviolent cases with people who don't have a criminal history. They say Smollett had to do some community service and will donate his $10,000 bond to the city. Here's Cook County First Assistant State's Attorney Joseph McGatz explaining.
I mean, I think it's being read as some type of vindication or statement that there was something wrong with the police investigation in this case. That is categorically not true.
But, you know, Adi, this has been a really high-profile case, and that raises some questions about this decision. We talked to one former county prosecutor who said that this is not the normal way to deal with a case as serious as this one.
And the Chicago police were very forceful, right, in denouncing what they said that Smollett did. So how did they react to today's news?
Yeah, you know, Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson, he went on national TV to talk about this. I mean, there were a bunch of press conferences, you might remember. And Johnson and Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel responded to the charges being dropped this morning, and they were livid. And it's worth noting here that the state's attorney's office is separate from police. Johnson said they found out about it at the same time we, the media, did. Mayor Rahm Emanuel seemingly took a shot at the state's attorney's office for this decision.
This is without a doubt a whitewash of justice and sends a clear message that if you're in a position of influence and power, you'll get treated one way. Other people will be treated another way. There is no accountability then in the system.
Yeah, so, you know, the mayor and Superintendent Johnson, I mean, they were really insistent that Smollett is guilty, that he was indicted by a grand jury, but he will no longer be facing any county criminal charges. But as of last month, the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was also looking into Jussie Smollett for allegedly faking a threatening letter to himself. And I called the Chicago FBI this afternoon, and they very much declined to comment.
That's Miles Bryan. He's a reporter with member station WBEZ. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Time! Oh, shit, don't tell me my niggas got lost in time. My niggas are dying before their time. My niggas are serving unjust time. My niggas are dying because of time.
And this is Brittany Cooper.
Hello, Professor Cooper.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Hi, it's Guy Raz here. How are you?
Hi.
You are indeed, as you say in your talk, always on time and in fact early.
Yes, trying to be always.
Brittany's a professor.
Yes, so I'm Associate Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers University.
And Brittany's sense of being on time was something her mom taught her pretty early on.
Well, my mom worked as a secretary, and so she was working her way up through this company, and so she was on very regimented time. And part of what she was trying to do was create a pathway into the middle class, and so that meant showing up and being professional. It meant speaking great corporate English in many cases, and it had everything to do with the importance of professionalization and trying to create a pathway, because we're working class black family from very modest roots. And she wanted more for herself, and she was a single mom with only a high school education at the time. And so these were some of the markers of trying to have class mobility. And so they're very small ways to think about it, but in my educational context that were predominantly white, we couldn't be late because we were trying to project a sense of excellence and that we were about business, that I should be taken seriously as a student and that she should be taken seriously as a parent.
And this idea that time could be connected to something bigger, something intangible, was actually the focus of a talk Brittany gave back in 2016.
What if I told you that time has a race? A race in the contemporary way that we understand race in the United States.
Here's more from Brittany Cooper on the TED stage.
Typically, we talk about race in terms of black and white issues. In the African-American communities from which I come, we have a long-standing multi-generational joke about what we call CP time, or colored people's time. Now, we no longer refer to African-Americans as colored, but this long-standing joke about our perpetual lateness to church, to cookouts, to family events, and even to our own funerals remains. I personally am a stickler for time. It's almost as if my mother, when I was growing up, said, "We will not be those black people." So we typically arrive to events 30 minutes early. But today,
I want to talk to you more about the political nature of time. For if time had a race, it would be white. White people own time.
Can you explain what you mean that time has a race?
Yes. So when I say time has a race, I'm saying that the way that we position ourselves in relationship to time comes out of histories of European and Western thought. And a lot of the way that we talk about time really finds its roots in the Industrial Revolution. So prior to that, we would talk about time as merely passing the time. After the Industrial Revolution, suddenly we begin to talk about time as spending time. It becomes something that is tethered to a monetary value. So when we think about hourly wage, we now talk about time in terms of wasting time or spending time. And that's a really different understanding of time than, you know, like seasonal time or time that is sort of merely passing. And so I wanted to think about what does it mean if people are considered folks who largely are not impacting the flow of things, right? Which is often a racialized idea. So when we think about Black and brown peoples around the world, in Western frameworks, there is a way that Black and brown people are seen as a lag on social progress. So they are seen as holding back the, you know, power of the West to modernize the world. And that becomes the pretext often to do all manner of violence. Time has a history, and so do Black people. But we treat time as though it is timeless, as though it has always been this way, as though it doesn't have a political history bound up with the plunder of indigenous lands, the genocide of indigenous people, and the stealing of Africans from their homeland. When white male European philosophers first thought to conceptualize time and history, one famously declared, "Africa is no historical part of the world." He was essentially saying that Africans were people outside of history who had had no impact on time or the march of progress. This idea that Black people have had no impact on history is one of the foundational ideas of white supremacy. It's the reason that Carter G. Woodson created Negro History Week in 1926. It's the reason that we continue to celebrate Black History Month in the U.S. every February. Now, we also see this idea that Black people are people either alternately outside the bounds of time or stuck in the past in a scenario where, much as I'm doing right now, a Black person stands up and insists that racism still matters, and a person, usually white, says to them, "Why are you stuck in the past? Why can't you move on? We have a Black president. We're past all that."
I wonder whether that question or those questions are another, it's almost as if the person either implicitly or not is sort of saying, "I'm not interested in honoring or acknowledging your story."
Right. Absolutely. You know, the more generous thing that I can say is that part of what exposing these operations of time should allow us to think about is that we don't all have the same timescapes. And so if you're white in the U.S. context, typically you are taught that time is linear, that every day is a progression beyond the past, that we are not today where we were 50 years ago. But if you are African American in this country, time doesn't exactly work that way. You are, you know, living often with the residue of past historical trauma. You are living in a present day system that is filled with racial animus, which often is overlooked by many white Americans. And so you're also living with a sort of notion of a precarious future that you can be, you know, it reminds me in my book, Eloquent Rage, I write about the story of Sandra Bland, who was killed in 2015 after an encounter with the police.
Hello, ma'am. Was it takes time told the reason for your stop is you didn't fail. You failed to signal the lane change.
But what was most difficult for me was Sandra Bland is pulled over and arrested.
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car.
As she's driving into Prairie View A&M University down in Texas, which is her alma mater, and so she can literally, like, the university is sort of right there.
You have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
And she has just gotten her dream job, and this was the whole purpose of this journey that she takes down from Chicago. And she is yanked out of that future through a police encounter that is so reminiscent of the past.
Get out of the car! And then you I will light you up. Get out!
Wow.
Now!
Wow.
Get out of the car!
Really, for a failure to signal. You're doing all of this for
get
a failure.
Over there.
And it reminds me of the ways that past and presents and futures seemingly coexist for African-American folks. And so in that way, time doesn't feel linear. It feels like the past, you know, past narratives of race that are rooted in violence and rooted in a lack of freedom, they feel like they can become our reality again at any moment.
Stop now! Stop it!
And it's why sometimes when you talk to African American folks, particularly young folks, you will see them say, well, things haven't changed very much. We're still not free. And that always irritates the liberal-minded. How can you say things have not changed much? We've had a black president. You are not enslaved. But what they are saying is that the feeling that at any moment we could elect a white supremacist to the presidency again in 2016 as we did, or that the police could do harm to African-American citizens and do so with impunity, reminds us and recalls for us histories that we have been told that we are past, but which we are still living.
What do you see? I don't know. I don't know what white people see, you know, when they look at a Negro anymore. But I do know very well. Whatever he was looking at, it wasn't me. It wasn't me.
Racism isn't always obvious, but it can be found almost everywhere. In the language we use to describe certain groups, in the ways laws are written to protect those with power, and in opportunities given or even held back. So today on the show, we're going to explore the effects of everyday racism and how to confront it, and why one of the first steps towards defeating racism is to acknowledge its existence, both in the past and the present. Why do you think it's so difficult for Americans, and let's be frank, for white Americans, to talk about the past in a frank and empathetic way?
It's a great question.
It's maybe better for me to answer the question.
You know, look, I mean, I think that it is, a certain form of opportunism, because I think that white Americans see themselves as people who work really hard, and they believe in the myth of meritocracy. We're all indoctrinated into this myth. It's the American myth, right? You come to this country, you work hard, and anything is possible for you. And so anyone who doesn't have the things that they say they want, they don't have them because they didn't work hard.
Yeah.
And so then when you have to listen to people of color point out all the ways in which that isn't true, it disrupts a fundamental identity narrative for many white American folk about how they came to their prosperity. And really, it comes down to a very basic sense that what I think white Americans hear often in conversations about race is that we are saying to them, you are bad people and everything you have, you don't deserve, as opposed to saying, we are all in this particular historical moment born into a set of conditions that are not of our own making. Our ancestors were negotiating these conditions, and your ancestors positioned you to benefit greatly. And so that inability to sort of both take accountability for being beneficiaries of centuries of inequality, and also to recognize that no one is commenting on your personal morality, but saying that America is about a system of justice. And if we're going to actually live up to our stated creed of liberty and equality and justice, then we've got to think at a systemic level about how to do that. And that might mean some personal discomfort.
That's Brittany Cooper. She's an associate professor at Rutgers University and author of the book eloquent rage.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
The Pierce County Medical Examiner oversees hundreds of death investigations a year in Washington's second largest county, and that office is in turmoil. A flurry of complaints have criticized the medical examiner's management style and job performance. KNKX's Will James and Kari Plogue looked into the complaints and found staff members full of doubts and families searching for answers. More from South Sound reporter Will James. And a warning, this story contains descriptions of death, including a possible suicide.
Nina Summerize knows the woods of East Tacoma. She played in them as a kid. On this day, many years later, she's here searching for an abandoned well.
To get there, we're going to have to climb over those trees.
It's far off the trail, near a creek. It takes a long time to see it through the brush.
I found it.
This cement tube is where the body of Summerize's 41-year-old son, Ian Shurls, was found in November. It's narrow, just about 20 inches wide. There's water 10 or 15 feet down.
It looks very old, like there's all moss and little plants growing on the sides.
Summerize first came here days after her son's body was found. She wanted to see the well for herself.
Even though I was told he didn't suffer, I'm thinking, how do you not suffer if you drowned it down there?
It took days for emergency workers to pull Shirls' body from the well, but just hours for the medical examiner's office to call his family with a conclusion about how he died. They said it was suicide by drowning. The office's report cites foreboding statements Shirls made the day he went missing. But to his mother, it never made sense that Shirls would choose to drown in this 20-inch pipe. There was no note, and there are unexplained details, like why a mobile phone was found on his head. Summerize says she called the medical examiner's office, but never got an explanation for how he reached his conclusion. Her son was a Black man dealing with meth addiction. Summerize came away feeling like the people charged with investigating his death didn't take it seriously.
It's just easy just to brush your hands and say, yep, yeah, we'll call it suicide and be done with it, instead of really looking into what happened here. Honestly, I just want answers. I want to know what happened to my son. If people didn't do their jobs, I want them held accountable for that.
Since late January, Pierce County Medical Examiner Thomas Clark has faced criticism from families and his own staff. 9 current and former employees filed official complaints against him this year. They focus in part on Clark's treatment of staff and his behavior around the office, but they also criticize his handling of investigations. Clark, a medical doctor and Pierce County's highest paid employee, has been in office for nearly a decade. Publicly, he's known for honoring people whose remains go unclaimed in an annual burial at sea ceremony on Puget Sound. But some employees say, at the office, Clark is prone to making insensitive comments about certain categories of people and seems to come to hastier conclusions about their deaths. Those include people who were obese, elderly, homeless, or drug addicted. Here's his second-in-command, Associate Medical Examiner Megan Quinn.
He'll sit at morning meeting and say, okay, so we just have 2 drug addicts and 2 fat people, is that right? Very dismissive.
Quinn's predecessor, John Matthew Lacey, shares many of the same concerns. He's now with the Snohomish County Medical Examiner's Office, but worked under Clark for 5 years.
I think that in most cases, he knows what he's going to call the case before he leaves the morning meeting.
7 other staff members, including several death investigators, outlined their list of complaints in a union grievance last month. Among them is that the medical examiner has told staff to only x-ray or photograph certain body parts and exclude details that don't support his findings. They say Clark seems to avoid doing autopsies in an unusual number of cases and concludes people died of things like heart disease or alcohol abuse when their medical histories don't back that up. Some employees said in interviews they believe Clark makes determinations just to contradict other professionals, including doctors and police. Here's Quinn, his second in command.
It doesn't seem to have any rhyme or reason. It is about him. I think it's about power and control, and there is absolutely no place for power and control in what we do.
Quinn filed complaints with Pierce County and the State Medical Commission in January. She says the last straw was the case of a 15-month-old baby. Doctors and police, she says, were concerned bruises and signs of a healing fracture pointed to child abuse. But she says Clark argued the child died from someone accidentally lying on her.
If there has been an articulated opinion by another professional, whether that is a pediatrician, a law enforcement professional, a prosecutor, the pattern is that he contradicts it and he makes his findings fit that.
After Quinn filed her complaints, Pierce County officials placed her on paid leave and accused her of insubordination and other charges. Quinn's attorney calls it retaliation. The county denies that. Clark's attorney has called Quinn's complaints fabricated and vindictive. KNKX reached out to Clark, and he declined to comment through a county spokeswoman. Pierce County says it takes any allegations against Clark seriously and is investigating. A medical examiner's conclusions affect criminal investigations, life insurance payouts, and public health statistics. Lacey, who used to work for Clark, says the job depends on the public's trust.
When the trust is there, nobody thinks about the medical examiner. I think it's only when all of a sudden there's a question and people start to get that uneasy feeling, when families start coming forward and requesting additional reviews, that means that the faith in the medical examiner is gone. And the question then is, can that person ever be effective in their job?
A common thread in all the accounts is that Clark rarely talks to families of the people whose deaths he's investigating. Lacey and Quinn say that's unusual, and a core part of the job is helping families come away with a sense of closure. For Summerize, whose son's body was found in the well, that's exactly what she's looking for. Her family is one of at least three that have come forward this year with questions about why the medical examiner ruled their loved ones' deaths suicides.
I describe it as puzzle pieces. I have all these puzzle pieces, but they're not fitting together. And it's the unanswered questions that are preventing me from putting this puzzle together.
That's why she goes back to the well. Even though the scene is trodden over, her son's body is cremated, and in many ways, the time for investigation has passed, she's still trying to make sense of what happened. Will James, KNKX News.
The man knot. Race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Lynching is a shameful part of American history that you may have thought most people found hard to admit and would now rather forget. But violence against black people was often a public spectacle. It was, and in some ways still is, brazenly memorialized. Filmmaker Jacqueline Olive became interested in the history of lynching. Her research began with stories of long ago, but soon enough landed her right here in North Carolina with the 2014 death of Lennon Lacey. Lennon was a 17-year-old African-American man found hanging from a swing set in the town of Bladenboro. Bladenboro police called it a suicide. The community called it a modern-day lynching. Jacqueline Olive's film, Always in Season, won a special jury award at Sundance. It screens in Durham at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival next week, and she is with us now. Jacqueline Olive, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
Take us back to an exhibit, I think, that got you thinking about lynchings and made you want to learn more.
Yeah, there's an exhibit called the Without Sanctuary exhibit, Lynching Photographs and Postcards. And it is a collection of images of lynching victims, black people hanging, surrounded by the smiling faces of white men, women, and children. So often until through a certain period of probably about the 1930s or 1940s, lynching was a spectacle event. And so men, women, and children would come out to watch a lynching as an event. People would bring their families or their neighbors or their friends. And photographs were taken. A photographer would set up in the middle of a lynching, adjust for lighting, for composition, and photograph the violence as it happened. And people would also come up and pose with the bodies of the victims afterwards. And those photographs were often turned into postcards. And so when I moved back to my home state in Mississippi in the early 2000s, I saw that exhibit. And what really struck me was that the faces of the victims could have been my family members. They could have been my friends. They could have been my neighbors, the people that I knew. Prior to that, I thought, like a lot of people, about lynching when I thought about it at all as just anonymous, the victims as anonymous black men hanging.
And the fact that these were not only photographs, I think we may have known that they were public spectacles. I think this is perhaps widely taught, I would hope so, and there are renderings in this. But the fact that these photographs were actually postcards distributed as such is very telling about how they functioned in the social order. This was not something that happened behind the scenes. It was a very public spectacle that performed a very important function where it was carried out.
Absolutely. There's a myth that lynchings happen in the middle of the night in the backwoods, carried out by backwards redneck people is often the stereotype. But they were lynchings were attended without necessarily any affiliation with the Klan. And even when there was a Klan affiliation, hoods were rarely used. The Klan membership was similar to what might be the Sierra Club membership of the time. It was commonplace. And so people attended lynchings fully, openly, and unabashed. And they attended those often in the middle of town on the courthouse lawn, on the public square, in the middle of day, and posed proudly for photographs. And that happened often where half the town would come out. In a lynching in Waco, Texas in 1916, 15,000 people came out to that lynching.
Now, for 15,000 people to come out in time for the lynching also suggests that these were not the spontaneous episodes of mob violence. They were often advertised in advance, were they not?
They were. So in Always in Season, we have some segments of documentation from lynchings that Danny Glover reads. And I wanted to include that because so that people understand how organized the events were. He read an invitation to the 1934 lynching of Claude Neal in Marianna, Florida. That invitation was dispersed by telegram in the local newspapers and by radio for people to come and attend the lynching. So they were highly planned events. And it was also about this message of the power dynamics of white supremacy and maintaining that.
Yeah, and that is well laid out throughout the film as we learn about the history of lynching, which ultimately will bring us to North Carolina in 2014. But here's a clip of Cheryl Ifill, who is the president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, talking about the function of lynching.
Most black men were lynched because they were accused of having sexually assaulted a white woman for murder or some violent act committed usually against a white man. But sometimes it could just be having violated the rules of, you know, not having tipped one's hat or having left the side of the street when a white person was walking past. It could be being regarded as uppity. And it really involves a process of dehumanization, that the black man had to be physically restrained, that he was over-sexualized, that he was naturally and inherently violent, or something that's not human.
That's from the documentary Always in Season. That is Cheryl Ifill with the history lesson on lynching. Always in Season screens at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival in Durham next Friday evening. I'm talking with Jacqueline Olive, the film's writer, director, and producer. So we talk about the function of this. And you were actually years into filming this film when you heard about Lennon Lacy.
I was. The film is a decade in the making, and I researched the subject for 2 years before I began filming in 2010. And so I spent a lot of time really wanting to understand the scope of the terrorism. And then I started to find that there were people on the ground doing work to confront this history, to look at how to memorialize the victims, how to repair the damage in their communities in order to build a groundwork for reconciliation. And so I filmed in communities like one of the ones that's featured in the film in Monroe, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, where a group of reenactors get together every year to annually reenact a quadruple lynching that happened there in 1946. And they do that to make sure that the victims are never forgotten. And so it's those stories that really drew me to understand how this country might move towards justice and reconciliation.
Tell us the story of Lennon Lacy.
So I filmed for 4 or 5 years and saw in the media that Lennon was found hanging in Bladenboro, North Carolina. He was found hanging from a swing set on August 29th, 2014. And I reached out to his mother, Claudia, and spoke with his older brother, Pierre, to get more details. And the more that I talked with them, the more that I realized there were so many parallels to what had been going on historically in communities that were dealing with the fallout of historical lynchings. And so one of the inconsistencies in the evidence is that they believe that the shoes that that were found on Lennon's feet were not his. They were a size 10 and a half, and Lennon wore a size 12. And so there are inconsistencies in the evidence. There's the fact that he was dating a, at the time, 31-year-old white woman in a town with sharp racial divisions, a small town of 1,700 people. Bladenboro is also small in, you know, in, by definition of small towns, it's extraordinarily small. And also it is geographically isolated. And so it is a town in which these kind of stories, these kind of cases could be easily overlooked. And so I really wanted to understand more about what happened and to really look at that case in depth.
You talked with Lennon's mother, as you said, Claudia Lacey, and she talks about the day that he died and the way that she was told about this or actually brought to the scene by the police. Let's listen.
Think about it as if it was your son or your daughter. If you knew in your heart and in your mind that someone took your child's life, and everything that you've done is humanly possible, they taken it and twisted it and turned it, how far would you go to get to the truth? How soon would you let it go?
Claudia Lacey, the mother of Lennon Lacey, found hanging from a swing set in Bladenboro nearly 5 years ago. Lennon Lacey's family and his story profiled in the documentary Always in Season, screening at the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival next Friday. I'm talking with filmmaker Jackie Olive. There are a number of inconsistencies in the story. As you say, number one, the fact that he wasn't wearing his shoes when he was found. Questions about the belt that he was found around his neck, not his clothing. The fact that he was dating a white woman at the time. And the fact that, you know, there's also a history of the Bladenboro police who had been involved in a horrific scandal involving drug sales and the and extortion of black men in the town. All of this adds up to a lot of suspicion. Talk about how the story unfolds in Bladenboro and how these communities are handling it at the time.
Yeah, it adds up to a lot of questions. And the reason why I felt it was really important to that this story really frame the narrative for the film is because, like lynchings historically, there was a very swift investigation and very cursory. And so within 3 days, the police came to Claudia and Pierre and told them that Lennon committed suicide. And Claudia did not believe that her son committed suicide. She doesn't know what happened, but she wants answers, and she wanted answers. And so she worked with the North Carolina NAACP, with Reverend William Barber, to get an FBI investigation opened into the case. And so we follow that journey. Ultimately, the FBI did open an investigation into the case. That's actually quite unusual. It's quite unusual in the context of the spate of hangings that have been going on since 2005 of black people found hanging contemporarily in public spaces from trees. Heather Radelaide, who is the attorney who helped to bring the evidence to the FBI for the Lacey family, Heather found that there were 20 similar hangings of black people across the country from 2005 to 2016, and it's still continuing. There was the hanging of Otis Byrd in my home state of Mississippi in 2015, and Ben Cada, who was found hanging, a Muslim teenager, 18, who was found hanging outside of Seattle, Washington, from a tree in 2017. There's been a recent case of Donye Jones, who was found hanging in St. Louis, Missouri. And so these cases are frequently swept under the rug, called a suicide, with very little investigation, and that Claudia was able to get an investigation open really speaks to her determination and her her commitment to finding answers in this case, and also the way that people came together to support her in this. There are so many parallels historically when lynchings, less than 1% of lynchings, lynching cases ever went to trial historically. And so there are these parallels that really spoke to me and were really resonant beyond just the question of who done it around Lennon. It's really a bigger question for me. about what authorities are doing, what is going on systemically with policing and with the criminal justice system in these cases and in these communities nationally.
Yeah, you talked about how swiftly it was the investigation was carried out, and among the inconsistencies, the SBI was called in, but they assigned an expert in suicide and not in homicide. Big difference in the way you handle the evidence, big difference in what you're looking for. And so if you don't have a homicide investigator, you're likely to lose a lot of important evidence because you're not experienced. Not only that, but apparently the coroner who was called as a medical examiner was not allowed to take pictures, started taking pictures, and police took his camera away from the scene, which attorneys found unusual, if not unprecedented. The investigation that you talked about found that there was, in fact, nothing to overturn the decision that it was suicide.
The investigation, actually, the FBI investigation found that there was not enough evidence to pursue a homicide investigation. They didn't determine that it was a suicide, but that there wasn't enough there to pursue a homicide investigation, which is understandable when on the ground, when that physical evidence is not collected in the way that the case really merits.
Right. As we said, a lot of the evidence, the photographs and having the right kind of detectives on board from the beginning suggests a loss of the kind of evidence that the FBI might have been looking for. So what about the coverage in the press at that time? What did you find?
Yes, I found that that Lennon's case was I found a couple of things. One is because I came on to the story from having looked at from having found it in the news. And I think that because it was Lennon's death happened shortly after Michael Brown was gunned down in Ferguson, Missouri, that it was overshadowed by the movement that was going on there in Ferguson around the protest. But also, I think that it actually was a bit of a benefit because people were starting to look at racial violence generally in this country. Regardless of how it began, I think that the news coverage is typical of the way that news coverage goes and the way that really actually we're encouraged to look at racial justice issues in this country generally. Is to look for simple solutions and to ask simple questions. And so to frame this story in the case of whodunit means that once you have an answer, whether or not Lennon was murdered, whether or not he was lynched, or whether or not he committed suicide, then we can move on. But there are bigger questions that are incredibly important that we need to unpack around, one, the way that journalists show up in the context of these deaths and in these cases, that whether or not the focus is on just as much on the issues around policing in Bladenboro, including other issues around inequity in education and all of the other issues of systemic racism that are mirrored there as it is across the country.
Do you think that is, as you said, there have been a number of cases now where we're forced to at least look at the case and the whodunit part of it, but this film and other kinds of coverage around these cases, do you think we are taking a more sustained look and a deeper look at the systemic causes, or are we still kind of one and done?
I hope we are. I'm naturally an optimist, and so I think that I can see how there are instances in which we are taking a more in-depth look. But I think that there's room for us to really examine these issues more with more complexity, with more nuance, and to really dig in to the questions that are apparent. I'll have to say apparent to people of color in these communities, but not necessarily apparent to mainstream media, which tends not to be. Completely inclusive of people of color. And so as we start to get more aware of our biases and our need for diversity, then I am really optimistic that we'll start to ask deeper questions and more questions that are more central to the issues that are going on in communities like Bladenboro.
Jacqueline Olive is the writer, director, and producer of the documentary Always in Season. It's going to screen at Full Frame Documentary Film Festival Friday, April 5th. You can find the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Jackie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Black babies cost less.
Dramatic incident caught on video in the suburbs. A witness captured the incident unfolding outside of a store in Joliet. The fight may have started over a parking space, but it then got violent. NBC5's Michelle Rutherford is live in Joliet. She spoke with that victim's mother earlier today. Michelle.
Marion, that victim's mother tells me she's lived in Joliet all of her life, more than 30 years, and never experienced anything like this before. A warning, this story contains explicit language that has been censored. A witness recorded this cell phone video showing a hate-filled attack on a young boy.
I lost it. I wanted to do something to him.
The boy's mother tells me her 9-year-old son was punched in the face by a 57-year-old man.
He kind of still traumatized. I don't know if he's going to need some counseling or myself.
This scene played out in the parking lot of this Dollar General in Joliet. Aisha Powell says the man in the video was angry about a handicapped parking space.
The guy came in, the Wayne guy, he said, who the F parked in a red car in a handicapped spot, which I was parked right here. You know what I'm saying? Not even in handicap.
According to Powell, even after she relocated her vehicle, the man continued to taunt her and her kids inside and outside the store, calling them racist names and putting his hands in her face.
You calling my kid out? And I finna show the and I finna show him. My son ran up like, come on, mama. And he, like I said, he said the N-word to him. And then I, when he swung on him and punched him, I had him already. My hand on the mason, I sprayed the whole can.
Joliet police say the suspect, Wayne Orkwizuski, was arrested and charged with battery, assault, and disorderly conduct. Powell believes he should be charged with a hate crime.
I am scared. I don't want to bring my kids out in public no more. I feel like I need protection everywhere I go now that it's all in the public. It was a hate crime to me.
The suspect has been released on his own recognizance. Powell says she would like an apology for her family and hopes that would help them all move forward. In Joliet, I'm Michelle Rulliford, NBC 5 News. Back to you.
All right, Michelle, thank you very much.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, March 30, 2019, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have views, thoughts, counter-racist suggestions. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I do not have children. However, I've discussed on the program before, I believe it was about this time last year, I was at a birthday party for a 1-year-old. I was holding the 1-year-old. His parents were combating a suspected race soldier, white woman. I said at that incident, I said, oh, wow, I don't have children. But in this instance, me being an attempted counter-racist, and now I have a 1-year-old that I'm holding, my behavior is substantially different. I talked about it on the program. I said, I am not in engage mode. I am in, let's leave. Like, I don't want to talk. The baby doesn't have a coat. Like, let's leave. We can, you know, do an email. We can do a text later. I'm not going to sit out here and get into some sort of verbal tussle with a child. And I talked about that. I said, wow, I don't have children. So I'm accustomed to going about attempted counter-racist business where it's just me. Having offspring dramatically impacts your counter-racist code and how you are going to function in a given situation. What I recommend and my code, I think I've said it explicitly on the program. And this is, Mr. Fuller talked about this on the archives, I think in 2013. You're in an environment, white man, white woman, white child is yelling, nigger, being hostile. Get out of that area immediately. Like, that is the suggestion, even if it's just you, even if you, you know all of the martial arts, you know, you can bench press 1,000 pounds, you know, you are tough with, you know, all capital letters. Great. When that sort of thing starts happening, flee. That was the recommendation because so many things, we did a whole program in a matter of minutes. You can be sitting in ruin or worse. Things can get lethal quickly. VGQ, Victims Guarantee Qualified, always, but if I have a child and I see a race soldier in an aggressive manner, I would flee. Even if she, let's say she had not had mace in the instant that we just heard from, even if she didn't have mace, let's say she had a firearm. Instead of macing him, bam, as soon as he came over, bullet right between the eyes. Okay. You do have lots of other race soldiers, and they do brag about having firearms, so they could have retaliated and killed her. That hasn't been known to happen. Armed black female, Miriam Carey. Just to say, even if you have a firearm, it's in a system of racism, white supremacy, that situation, in so many ways that can go bad. If you can get out of there, get out of there. Then you can report and do whatever else needs to be done. That is my recommendation. And I guess I would especially stress that if you're in that sort of situation and you have small children with you, because it's so dangerous. And I'm not a parent. I would not want to take that risk with a child, having been in that type of situation with small children where I was, kind of pretending as a caretaker, so to speak. that's the exact code that I followed. Like, it's not worth it. I don't want to risk it, with the child. Let's get them to a safe position. And then, we can do all the verbal jousting with race soldiers and all of that from a safe position. That's why I said, man, being an attempted counter-racist parent, wow. In a system of white terrorism, wow. What a task. Why I don't have offspring. Compensatory call-in, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to share before we get started. I will emphasize self-care. Extremely important. I think many of us, all of us probably, if we are black people in a system of white terrorism, you have incidents where you get abused on the job. I think Stacey in the UK was talking about that, being so abused that she was seeing how it was impacting her functioning on the job, how it had impacted her black self-respect, apparently. Well, I might be paraphrasing, but it had a traumatic impact, all of the abuse that she was suffering on the job. And I think that is all of us, especially when you have really acute incidents of violence, and it might not necessarily be physical violence on the part of whites, individuals classified as white, abusing and terrorizing us, that can take a toll to recognize that, and as best you can to try to recuperate, rest, do things that are constructive and replenishing for your body. A lot of times we can get into very destructive behaviors, but if you can get more rest, drink more water, get some exercise, get some time out in the sun, all of that, not going into, I'm going to binge drink and get, a fifth of this and some shots of that and all the rest of it. That is not constructive. That is not helpful at all. Racists love that sort of thing where they terrorize us and then give lots of toxic anecdotes to the stress and strife that they have heaped on us in great abundance. Continuing. Unfortunately, we will not have our California retreat. We were three people short. I was so disgusted because I had said we did not plan either of these retreats early enough. Generally, they are planned like 8 months, sometimes even a year in advance. And, we were planning like, I think 30 days ahead of time, both times. And like three people, if we had been 2 months earlier, maybe 3 months earlier, still learning. I greatly underestimated how powerful summer planning is. Like, people start planning a year in advance for these summer type of events for a reason. Now I will know. Next time around, we'll be prepared. And all of the rest of the retreats that we were looking at doing, they will all be planned appropriately. December 27th through January 1. That was the date we were looking at for Florida. That is still the planned date. We had people even who were saying, as they had other events already scheduled for the summertime, that they had time scheduled for Florida. I am very certain that that retreat is going to sell out, just because we have, like California, had lots of people who are listeners in the Florida area. This is planned well in advance, and I just don't think it'll be difficult to get. It'll still probably be the same amount of people if we can find a location that is capable of having a few more than 13. Maybe, but I would like to keep it at about the same number of people that we had in Virginia. So if more than 13 is possible, we'll see. But I'm very sure once we get everything confirmed that it will not be a problem, because all the rest of the retreats will be planned well in advance. But I am bummed about California. I was super excited to get back to California for the summertime. We will have to do a makeup for the folks in the California area, where we plan well in advance for the summertime. Toronto, July 2020. Well in advance. Well in advance. Other things before we get to folks who dialed in. We are listener-supported, counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Visit the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. Much obliged to all the folks who have invested for a decade in keeping us on the air. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Again, enormous gratitude to all of the listeners, investors who have supported. You are the reason we have been able to do counter-racist broadcasting for a decade. You can also support. Wishlist is at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. It is linked on the blog directly below the PayPal button. You can search it at Amazon, Gus T. Renegade. Again, extraordinary thanks to all the folks who have nabbed an item or three over the past 10 years. I hope the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy, and continues to offer accurate information on what it means to be classified as white. Other things, let's see. Brittany Cooper, professor at Rutgers, very important. We talked about her with the Bill Cosby case. She identified him as a terrorist. And I think some listeners raised the question, does she talk about white people as being terrorists? Now that, I said, I won't say defended her, but I remember stating categorically that she had talked about white supremacy. I feel like she has used the terms terrorism in describing what whites do to black people, and specific cases like Renisha McBride that she has talked about in great depth and publicly many, many times. And in my view, using correct terminology. But wow. If you compare that clip to Bill Cosby being a terrorist, VGQ, Victims Guarantee, qualified. If people remember that segment, it wasn't that long ago. If people remember, compare and contrast. I will say, my view, she talked about in that segment that when victims of racism talk to whites about white supremacy racism, that it somehow destroys their narrative, that they have worked hard, that they believe in all of this. I do not think that that's accurate. I do not think that that's true. Whites are not ignorant about this, about the cheating scandal. You know, if you paid this person, now look here, make it look like I was on the soccer team. You're not ignorant about that. You don't believe in that myth. That is great. Look at that. See me doing that bicycle kick? That is amazing.
I've never played soccer in my life. I've been eating Cheetos all day long. that's not, I believe in the mythology. That is, I am practicing racism. I know when I'm cheating. We've been cheating. We've been doing this for a long time, just like we've been mistreating niggers for a long time. We're not ignorant about that either. It is amazing. I can't say it is amazing, but that is a pattern where the pathologies of whites are consistently attributed to ignorance. They're ignorant about cheating. They're ignorant about racism. False. On all accounts, none of that makes sense at all. VGQ. Victims guaranteed qualified. Claude Neal was mentioned in the lynching segment documentary on Lennon Lacy. Sounds constructive. April 5th airing, folks in the North Carolina area. Claude Neal has been mentioned on the program many times. Mentioned, I think, quite a bit in Vincent Woodard, Delectable Negro, Homoeroticism, and Human Consumption in U.S. Slave Culture, Top 10, Gus T. Renegade. Let's see. Oh, from that same segment. I'm so thankful that Lennon Lacy being discussed, how quickly we can forget some of these cases. Frederick Jermaine Carter, I had the artwork from his lynching. I can't say artwork, it was the photos from the crime scene, the scene of the murder in Mississippi in 2010. Frederick Jermaine Carter, one of those more recent lynchings of black males. But in that segment, she was talking about Lennon Lacy. I'm so glad that case being discussed. People, you know, can forget quickly. But they said that Lennon Lacy, 17-year-old black male, was dating a 31-year-old white woman. Pamela Evans Harris used to comment on that on a regular basis. That is child rape. In the state of Washington, that is illegal and would be considered statutory rape. That is Mary Kay Letourneau. That's not even a metaphor. That is a specific race soldier, not a suspect, who was raping a non-white child right here in Seattle, Washington. I think they got married, as they say, after she did her... I think she got arrested. I think she did two different prison stints for raping this non-white child. At any rate... this is not dating. That would be statutory rape at minimum. Rape, not dating. 17 years. And again, I go back to the Love case, the Loving case in Virginia. When they met, this was a 17-year-old white man and an 11-year-old black female. That is not dating. That also is rape. Consistently, they will offer these sort of shabby comparisons as the, oh, this is interracial romance and dating. They were lovers. It's written. And show me the instance when it's a 31-year-old black male and a 17-year-old white female, and that's dating. They were just lovers. Picture them having ice cream together. Continuing. In the same segment, they talked about they were dating in a town with sharp racial divisions. They just had an article. I should read it. They didn't have audio for it. They just had an article where there was an update to the way that the Associated Press and journalists, the way that they talk about incidents of racism. They said to stop using terminology like that, sharp racial divisions and racial implications. They say if it's racist, just say that it's racist. Stop obfuscating. I said, oh my goodness. Some idiot says that all the time. Wow. Be direct, be clear. Make it plain. Documentary from Malcolm X. It's not. What does that even mean? No metaphors today. Compensatory call in. Be clear. Be explicit with what we're talking about. That is the beginning of knowledge. Calling things by their proper name. I have no idea what sharp racial divisions are. Are we talking about knives? Culinary set? I'm talking about white terrorism. That's how Lennon Lacy died. Terrorism, not sharp racial. It's so not explicit. this is so lopsided, it needs to be implicated in the way that we discuss this in terms of white terrorism is what is dominating, not sharp racial division. I mean, is sometime are the black people the ones that are coming over and lynching white teens and nothing can be done about it? Continuing, this is, as I said, no metaphors, compensatory call-in. So if we could be direct, race soldiers will regularly use words to obfuscate. They will offer comparisons between two entities and insist that they are identical, one and the same. And frequently, that is not the case. This is how you practice master deception, white supremacy. Victims, myself included, we have been exposed to this misbehavior for decades. And many of us, we are still learning. So sometimes we'll substitute an analogy, metaphor, in place of logic. Often this results in more confusion. Sometimes the best sequence or the best prospect is to just say, hey, I need to take a little more time to think, get my words, logic together, and then speak, as opposed to using an analogy or metaphor that may add to confusion. I will prompt about the metaphors. Words, right in line with the metaphors. Words are so important. I will have to talk about the past 11 days of yoga. Wow. We had a weeping white woman, and the white woman was weeping for Gus T. Renegade. It was, what an 11 days it has been. In the midst of that, words are critical. I had to use words to report white supremacist misconduct at the yoga studio, and white supremacist conduct in a most flagrant, undeniable way, way worse than a white person just calling you a spear chucker or a coon. Using correct words, using white supremacy, talking like I speak on the cows. Wow. The importance of words. I was literally standing with a non-white female who unfortunately is in a tragic arrangement, but wow, she has been absolutely spectacular throughout this ordeal. She has been super supportive. She actually is one of the few people at this studio who listened to the cows and let me know about it. You know, race soldiers can be real incognito, but actually went, checked out a program and came back to report on what she heard, because she heard content about white supremacy in Seattle specifically that she was stunned about, how they were booting all the Negro children out of the library. She didn't know about that at all. And we're, you know, right down the street from a public library. So she's been awesome the whole way through, super supportive in a variety of ways. We're there on, I believe, last Wednesday, somewhere in the middle of all of this. So we're there and she's confirming that, you know, people are talking about my charge that white supremacy racism has been practiced in a most flagrant, vile manner, and that I am a victim. And so she's reading the text to confirm, because they brought in a speaker to practice racism, essentially. And the white woman who hired this outside woman to come in, practice racism, she wasn't even present to confirm or refute the charge that I had made, that white supremacy racism was practiced against me and others. And so the white woman who did the hiring, she's having to go around and confirm, you know, what exactly happened in this here meeting. And so the victim, who has been super helpful, she says, I'm going to read you the text. She says, the white woman who did the hiring, she says, so did the lecturer, the speaker, Anna Brown Griswold, did she give a story about a black male being assaulted and stalked by a white woman in a yoga class? And she said, I texted back, yes, she did. And I would be happy to talk about it. I said, right on, right on. Using correct language, because that principle demonstrated, Mr. Fuller talks about that, frequently people will use the same words that you use. Racists employ this strategy better than anyone. They will deliberately use incorrect language, particularly when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. They will not use correct language, and this will get their victims to also use incorrect language. No, talk about things accurately. Assaulted and stalked by a white woman in a yoga class, and black male, not black, black male, the man not. Use correct language. I appreciated that. The hire of Anna Brown Griswold, who I believe Ivy reminded me so importantly. That program is so much more important now. So much more important. Anna Brown Griswold, from about this time 1 year ago, I believe admitted racist right here in the Seattle area. But Anna Brown Griswold admitted racist, I believe. I said she came here, she practiced racism, white supremacy deliberately against myself and other non-white people. The owner of this here yoga studio, a white woman, called Anna Brown Griswold, being paid to come there, a destructive hire. Buddy, don't you think Gus T is going to employ that? There are victims of Anna Brown Griswold's destruction, and I am one. Words are important. I cannot stress that enough. And being on code, I think there's so many ways that this situation could have been worse or been gone differently if I had not been codified and expecting white people to practice white supremacy racism. I had my cow shirt on for so many of the events that happened in this story. I had my please treat me like I am a white person, which just anyway, there will be much more to explain about all this. And again, hopefully we will have Anna Brown Griswold on the program, Encore Performance, to hear from her directly and her role in practicing white supremacy racism deliberately, willfully, consciously, and being compensated to do so. Final question. We'll get to the callers. If you have a white woman who practices racism, in my view, willfully, deliberately, and this white woman is hired by a different white woman, maybe the white woman knows she's going to be racist. Maybe she doesn't. That's irrelevant, really. Who is most to blame in this situation? The white woman who directly practices racism, white supremacy, or the white woman who does the hiring? Who is most to blame? Question. Number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you could take 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be appreciated, just to make sure everyone has at least one chance to share. If you have background noise, if you television, whatever it is, if you could please use your mute button, just helps to keep the interference down. We don't have to fight over a lot of unnecessary distractions. But if you could take roughly 5 minutes, if you have additional questions, suggestions, once everyone has shared at least once, we should have time. We can come back and get your additional comments. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, sorry. Am I being hurt?
Yes, sir.
How you doing, Gus?
Right poorly.
Yes, sir. I agree.
A few things I wanted to touch on. I heard in the, probably came in like halfway in through the clips. The lynching part. There was recently just a lynching in, I forget what city or state it was in, but the name is Tamon Blair, and it was ruled a suicide as well. He was 22. I think he had like a newborn kid on the way or something like that, and he was found lynched, and they ruled it a suicide as well very quickly. I recently just watched a documentary called The Long Shadow. Ironically, it's basically a documentary about a white woman from North Carolina. She realizes that her ancestors were actual slave masters, and I guess she tries to reconnect with the people that they owned. And it's very interesting. I think she would be a good person to interview. Because at the end of the movie, they literally had like a walk-off into the sunset, two black women and two white women laughing and smiling, like holding hands into the sunset. And that's literally how the documentary ended. If any victims want to check it out, it's worth checking out. It's called The Long Shadow. I just recently had a conversation with my grandma today. She knows my perspective on how I feel about Christianity and white supremacy and the interconnection between that. And she says I have a radical view of it. And she always gets on me. She always criticizes me for about not voting and wanting to hold out on a vote. And she always invokes Jane Pittman. And I still haven't seen that documentary yet. So, you know, I wanted to know if you could... Or what do you think about that personally, if you want to answer this question at now or at a later time, it's fine. Like, as far as, like, the older generation saying, like, oh, you owe it to your ancestors to vote, and Jane Pittman and stuff like that, because she's really been criticizing me about that. And, yeah, I just want to know other opinions, because at times when she tells me that, I'm often at a loss for words. Like, you know, what do you tell your grandma in a rebuttal to... voting with Jane Pittman, talking point and stuff like that. So I hope, you know, everybody stays safe on this Saturday night. That'll be it. Have a good one, guys.
Much obliged. Grandmothers are extraordinarily important. That's something the grandsister, Dr. Frances Cress-Welsing, she used to emphasize that on a regular basis. I guess about the vote, that's very common. I think some other listeners have expressed frustration about that same phenomenon in terms of older black people. When I say older, like grandmotherly, grandfatherly aged black people who might be, let's say, 70, 65 generation who kind of have that view. Not all, but I think it might be a little bit more common in that age group. I probably would minimize conflict. I don't know how much arguing I would do with my grandma or grandpa about voting. When I think of Jane Pittman, I just think of Cicely Tyson, when she's spitting in the water, for folks who've seen the movie. But yeah, I probably wouldn't, you know, do a whole lot of arguing with them about this stance. It would just be, okay, that's something to consider, Grandma. And that might be it. I wouldn't have a whole lot. Just like it just wouldn't be a back and forth argument type of thing. Like, you know, we would just move on to the next subject, or, you know, she would say whatever else she's going to say on it, and that would be that. But I just would not get into a big exchange about the whole thing. I've seen too many of those where it just kind of goes around and they have a view. That VGQ, that's why I keep saying VGQ. Say the same thing that I said before for Professor Brittany Cooper. VGQ to Grandma. Mm-hmm. And wait till we move on to the next topic. That would be the strategy I would use. Other folks can answer that question as we roll on. If they think that what I just said doesn't make sense, then add that, please, as well. Other folks, if we've not heard from you, proceed.
Not heard.
Yes, ma'am. You're a little low, so if you could speak up, that would be grand.
Oh, okay. Could you hear me better now?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, okay. Greetings, Phil and guests. This is Dr. Mania. I'm calling to report an incident that I had gone through in my residence. I had talked about it on the program before. I had been through an incident with a suspected racist supremacist that lived in my residence with me.
Your volume dropped again. Is it possible? I don't know if you could get closer to the receiver or speak up, maybe.
You know what? Can you hear me better now?
That's a little bit better.
I was talking about the guy that had been walking up behind me and like start on me, and how, you know, how we discussed that on workplace races and how they like to walk up behind you and like hear you and start at you. So I had addressed that issue with him before, and he had got like belligerent, and you guys had given me some suggestions on that. So there had been some more incidents where, like noise after hours, banging on my wall and things like that. So I had been like going to him and addressing him and like letting him know about it. And it hadn't been any issues. I had been very cordial about it. There had not been like any arguments about it or anything like that. But the incidents had still been going on. Even after I had been addressing them, it's like drum playing, loud music, and things like that, like after hours, like maybe like 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, right? So what I ended up doing, I emailed the owner and I let them know about it, and I had some people to address the issue. So after I did that, I hadn't heard anything back from the owner or anything. They never let me know that they had solved the issue with this man or anything. So what happened was the other day the incident happened like banging on my wall where it sounds like somebody is coming through the wall. So I go and I knock on it was actually on Friday, but I could talk about it on workplace racism because it wasn't workplace. So I go and knock on his door and I knock on his door, he doesn't answer, then I knock a little harder and he yelled at me, what? I said, well, you know, you're like, it sounds like you're coming through my wall, but you please stop banging through my, banging on the wall. But he says, it was just an accident. Like, he's yelling, like, out of, like, to the top of his lungs. It was just an accident. What the F, you know, it's just an accident. I said, well, listen, I mean, I just want to let you know, it sounds like you're coming through my wall. And I think it's very disrespectful that you're yelling and screaming and cursing at me. So I go down and continue to do what I'm doing. And, you know, it just kind of takes me back to you talking about when you're around, it's like when they're acting like that, how you want to just get away from those types of situations. Because you never know what these suspects might do, how they might explode or do whatever. And I mean, he was like really like cursing me out and like going off, right? So that's a metaphor, but he was really acting very irate. So I went downstairs to go take my clothes off the laundry, and he comes down, he slams the door, comes downstairs in the kitchen, and I had to wash my hand because I had some soap powder on my hand. So he says, can we just talk about this? And I said, listen, I was very calm. I said, listen, I am not going to have this conversation with you. I said, you are yelling. You are screaming. I'm not talking to you right now. I don't want to even have a discussion with you. So one of the other roommates so happened to be coming in the house and for the incident also. So how he just cursed and he started cursing and everything again, like acting really irate and crazy. So I had gotten a little upset because the owners never had gotten back to me after I had advised them about this. So what I had did, I had called the owners and I let them know what was going on. asked him why he didn't get back to me when I originally sent him an email about this incident, about the ongoing issue. So then she calls me back. She tells me that she's going to try to get in touch with her husband, try to see if they can resolve the issue or what happened. So basically, what they did is I'm going to have to use a metaphor that I've heard from the cows. They used the Voltron effect. What they did, I mean, I explained to them about the incident with him lurking behind me and scaring me. And because I mentioned, told him about, addressed that with them, what they were trying to do is, as opposed to dealing with the issue of the noise, they tried to make it do a Voltron effect to make it, to call themselves gaslighting me, to make me feel like I'm the problem because I'm addressing the issue about ongoing noise issue. And what they wanted to do is try to deflect and make it seem like it was about, as opposed to the actual issue, it's about me not liking him because he told them that since I believe in, I don't like him. And they wanted to have a one-on-one meeting with me and him to discuss the issues. I said, well, why is it that we need to have a meeting one-on-one? Like, all you have to do is resolve the issue. Since you're saying that the issue is that him, his arm is hitting the wall, then just move his bed. But I don't see if it's necessary that I have to sit down and talk to this man. It's not a love affair. It's not a kumbaya, come to Jesus talk. That we need to sit down and have a conversation about. Like, all we need to do is just try to resolve this issue. And the guy, when I was talking to the owner, he was basically just trying to make it seem like it was something I did. He said to me, well, is there something that you could have did differently? And it sounds to me that you, or you're perfect. Like, and when he started, like, doing that to me, I said, listen, I really don't want to continue to have this conversation. I said, and I really don't see how this is going to be constructed by me having a meeting with him, me, you, and him. I said, and furthermore, if there's an issue where other people in the household has been complaining because they complained about person saw him reacting the way he reacted, very irate and crazy at the time. If other people are complaining, why is it that you can't just have a meeting with everybody in the house? Why is it necessary that me and him just have a meeting? So what they wanted to do is get me, him and the owner together so they could do a Voltron effect and, like, stand up on me and try to make it seem like it's something that I'm doing wrong and I just need to, we just need to get along. And I let them know, like, all I need to do is just basically live in peace, be able to get some rest, not be woken up out of my sleep at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning because somebody wants to play drums, listening to loud music, and they're doing it all on purpose. Because how many times is it that I need to come and tell you the same thing about you disturbing and making disturbances? But they wanted to make excuses for his behavior, why he acted the way he acted, because he was sleeping. If that's the case, then while I'm sleeping and you're waking me up at night, I guess it would be appropriate for me to yell and scream and curse him out also, right? No, of course not. It wouldn't be. So I opted out of it, and I told him, you know, I don't want to have meetings. And the best way to address this issue is by letting him know to, like, have him move his bed and, like, let him be a little bit more respectful in how to not yelling and screaming and acting like a total a maniac. And, you know, that's how I resolved it. I was pretty happy that I didn't allow myself to get emotional. I didn't allow them to bait me into, like, any type of argument. Any type of, because it's very clear that that's what they were trying to do. They're trying to, like, he's trying to cause an issue and then have me react, and then so they can put it on me like I'm the problem.
Wow. I'm sorry you had to deal with that. We've had whole programs before about Black people being terrorized in their residence. by whites, and, you know, just the variety of problems that that can cause, and the stress of that, just, you know, the place where you reside not being a place where you can have any peace. I guess suggestion I would offer, when it's excessively noisy like that, and I know we've talked about this before, that might be a situation where one can consider if you want to call the enforcement officers to deal with the situation. I know myself, if you go and you knock and he's yelling and cursing through the door, that's when I think I would have called enforcement officers, and I think I would have started recording. I would have began recording the noise in the house, since you have evidence of that, and then recording at the door, and I think I would have called the police at that point to just say that this person is behaving in a terroristic manner. They're cursing. It was excessive banging that you have recording of on the wall. I feel really unsafe in my own residence. Is it possible that an enforcement officer can deal with him directly because I feel unsafe? And I would just keep coming back to, this is a safety issue. You know, he's threatening. His conduct when he came out earlier, he's threatening, he's cursing, he's being loud. It seems he's in a complete rage and I feel unsafe. It would just keep coming back to, this is a safety issue with him being the perpetrator of the unsafety, of the rage, potential violence, and classifying his behavior as violent. The banging, the cursing, all of that is violent. And I didn't want to wait for it to escalate to physical violence. That would just be a suggestion. But yeah, I'm sorry you had to deal with that terrorism at your residence. That is terrorism. If folks have, yes, ma'am, Draftomania. If folks have suggestions for her situation, things that might be helpful for dealing with this race soldier, and or any of the other comments, news items that we heard, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Have you heard?
Let's see.
I'm from New York. I'm still trying to get my notes together. No, I'm still trying to get my notes together. Thank you so much, though, but I'll mute my line. Go ahead.
No problem. Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Sword Chorus. Good evening, Ivy. I could not make out a word that Draftomania was saying. Her volume was very low. To your question, Gus, all white people should be responsible for one racist. The racist herself, the white woman who hired her, and all the whites who observed her racism are at fault and should be perceived as racist as well. And in legal words, they're accessories to the racism, complicit in the racism, accomplice liabilities for the acts of racism. And in layman terms, we call that guilty by association. And that's how I look at them. So I couldn't pick which one to blame because they're both at fault equally. Israel isn't real. It's an illegal nation, state practicing modern day colonialism, racism called Zionism. Semites means two things, mixed race or people who speak one of the languages from the Afro-Asiatic language group. And Germans, Polish, Russians, Hungarian, and other people from Europe do not speak those languages and they're not mixed race. They occupy that area today. The people that's there, they speak Yiddish or other Germanic Slavic languages as their first language, not Afro-Asiatic language. The mixed people who speak an Afro-Asiatic language are the Arabs who speak Arabic, and they're obviously mixed. So those are the people who are being attacked. Those are the people when they're attacked. We should say that's anti-Semitism. The Arabic, well, Israel was created by the UN in 1948, and I don't call that land Palestine either because that was just created 25 years earlier in 1923. By British mandate. So neither one of them are real, but what they're doing to those people is wrong. I don't call acts of abuse Jews as anti-Semitism because they're white people. The gay rights movement will change everything. Jussie Smollett, I went on record saying he should not go to jail for making a false police report. You see white people get away with this every day. Be a woman calling the police on an 11-year-old saying he tried to rape her or whatever. They don't go to jail for it, and neither should he. He makes a police report that he gets beat up, a whole story that he gets attacked by two white men in MAGA hats, Make America Great Again, who place a noose around his neck, pour bleach on him, and call him a nigger and a faggot. It becomes a big media story about a crime that links both racism and LGBT together. That was on January 22nd when the midterms was coming to an end. The midterms ended January 26th. Right after this happened, the Democratic Party were running on the platform that if they won the House, they would pass the first 10 bills on their desk. Pelosi, Cory Booker, Harris, Cortez, Obama, and other white and black Democrat politicians used the Jussie Smollett attack to push the Equality Act just 4 days before the election. And of course, the Democrats took over the House. When it came out that he lied, they all deleted their tweets and their posts saying that they supported him. HR House Resolution 5 for the Equality Act. This act makes white men who are LGBT, it gives them the same civil rights as black people for the years of oppression that we got. This bill just got pushed through the Senate, through the House of Representatives on March 13th. And on March 26th, 2 months to the day of the election, they drop all the charges. Sounds to me like they use Mr. Smollett to push their agenda. It's an interesting sequence of events, and how the dates are coming up is just where we are. But if the Senate passes this bill through, gay white men will get affirmative action and all the benefits and things that white women have been able to get over the years by claiming to have a minority status. Now, on the other hand, the Chicago police, who get paid to solve crime, investigators follow leads all the way to Nigeria to get this case solved. But they can't solve half the murders on the south and west side of Chicago. In fact, I've seen the Chicago Police Department deleting videos and destroying evidence like they did in Laquan McDonald's case. For them to have the nerve to want the money back they spent on this investigation, I find to be terrible, being that they have such a terrible rate of solving the crimes that happen in their own city. They could go to Nigeria and solve a crime, though. So this is one thing I don't like. Rahm Emanuel pushing for this. Rahm Emanuel, an Israeli citizen. Whites control time. I like how that lady put that. How accurate is history that is based upon a timeline when the calendar we use, the Gregorian calendar, was introduced in the year 1582, commissioned by Pope Gregory XIII. Anything that happened before that date is really up for debate. What year happened? Because that's this calendar we're using. We say it's 2019. This is based off of the calendar that came out in 1852. What happened before 1852? What years are we using? How many years made up a year? I mean, so yeah, they control time. In fact, I'm talking on the phone now. It's 11:04 here. I'm sure Gus is on a whole other time when he looks at his clock. I mean, just to show you how much white people control time. All sex between white people and black people is statutory rape. I don't care if the black person is an adult and the white person is a child. In my opinion, the power dynamic is just so off. It just doesn't matter. Gus, there was a story this week. I spoke to the firefighter about it or texted him. It was a black lady who thought she was black her whole life. And at 70-something years old, she found out that both her parents was white. She was adopted by a black family, And she just thought she was a light-skinned black person. However, when you look at the lady, you obviously see that she is a light-skinned black person. So the story also went on to say when she came out and I guess she didn't get her white color, her father left her mother. So that kind of went on to it. And she had siblings who were all white. But either way, it kind of reminded me of the Lacey Schwartz story. In the story, you had a gentleman come on who had a similar story with his white mom who cheated on his father, but the father raised him like he was one of his own and but never treated him right. But either way, I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
Lacey Schwartz. I feel she was very dishonest on the program. That is, wow, Cal's Decade 2014, if memory serves. But yeah, wow. That document, was it Little White Lies? I think that's the documentary. If it's speaking of documentary, Little White Lies, I think that's it.
Yeah, her mother would get her a perm every week to keep her hair straight, but she's trying to pass off that she really thought she was white. Yeah, she was very dishonest.
Victim of racism, white supremacy, but man, she was, won't spend too. She said she was classified as so-called Jewish as well, but anywho. Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Ivy, did you have your notes together or did you need more time to collect your thoughts?
I got them. Thank you, Jeff. And greetings to you and all the callers on the line. Good evening, Thomas, New York, and Jeff to me and everyone else. I wanted to say that the Haitians, they're called the Haitians, but it's really pronounced IT instead of Haiti. The race soldiers got us saying Haiti. I remember it was mentioned, I think, last week about how one race soldier, some man, he had $60,000 or so worth of guns. I want to say that I don't think that we should allow that to, that we should be careful not to allow that to discourage us because the Haitians, who are called Haitians, they defeated race soldiers even though they were outgunned. A long time ago, and we can solve this problem. And the reality of it is that no matter what, in order to solve this problem, we are going to have a violent confrontation with race soldiers because they're violent. They just go around being violent toward people for no reason at all, just to practice racism. So, at any time, black people or other non-white people try to become self-sufficient or just do anything, they come with violence. So, I mean, we can't be intimidated by all of their guns and all their weapons and anything else. We just have to figure out how to outsmart them, and we can solve this problem regardless of how many guns they have. I wanted to mention some positive news about black people that I read. And it was from, I think they call it Nielsen Sound Scan, but it's Nielsen's, their numbers, NIELSON or SEN or something like that. And what the numbers show was that 48% more of black people add plant-based foods to their diets than the average person, and we lead in that. And next in line is, or behind us, after us, is the Asians, and then the Hispanics, and then a particular, for lack of words, a particular group of white people, not white people overall, like the rest of the group, but just a particular group of white people, and they're last. And who they are is they're called white millennials. And the last thing that I wanted to say is that I wonder if the people at your yoga studio, Gus, I wonder if they conspired against you from the beginning when you started taking all these classes, and I think you said you took over 600. And I wonder if they conspired against you to do this on purpose to make you quit so that you wouldn't get to 1,000. And the last thing I wanted to say is that I've been wanting to say to Thomas in New York for the longest time that I love your accent, and it's just real pleasant to hear you talk. I've been wanting to say that for so many years. But anyway, I'll mute my line. Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Gus. And thank you, Thomas in New York, and Gus for letting me go first, even though I didn't get to. But I'll mute my line.
Indeed. Indeed. I think that is a great question, Ivy, about trying to sabotage Gus from getting to 1,000. It has already been offered 3 months of free yoga as compensation for the shabby. As I said, this is like undeniable racism. It would have been, this is worse than if I had been called a nigger. So I was offered 3 months of free yoga. So if I wanted to continue my streak, I think they would probably pay for me to do so. I found the article, March 29. Call racism what it is. For obvious reasons, journalists get a lot more worked up about changes in the Associated Press style book, the de facto writing guide for news people. Words are important. But occasionally, a change signals a cultural or ethical shift in a button-down profession. On Friday, the AP offered new guidance on race should be white supremacy racism. Specifically, the language arbiter told news organizations to call racism what it is. The terms racism and racist can be used in broad references or in quotations to describe the hatred of a race or assertion of superiority of one race over others. Should be the white race, be clear. Identifying people by race and reporting on actions that have to do with racism often go beyond simple style questions, challenging journalists to think broadly about racial issues before having to make decisions on specific situations and stories. The AP also suggested getting rid of the term racially charged, a weak-kneed euphemism called pussyfooting, I think that's the one that I use, but I like that, to use by news organizations who know what racism and racists look like, but don't want to be pinned down on it. Very important report that I saw. Make sure I get that in. That was from yesterday, March 29. Other folks that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Greetings, Irie. Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you, Gus. Hello to all the listeners and callers. My mother told me something years ago that is going to stay with me the rest of my life. It sounds like a metaphor, but it's the truth. She said, dead men have no rights. And the reason why I'm saying that is because Black people are confused, if not confounded, thinking that they have rights that they can assert in the United States of America. Parking spots, it's not that serious. I was disturbed when I saw the video of a young woman in Dallas that not only did not egress when a white race soldier pulled a gun out on her, but she stayed in close proximity to him, which allowed him to make physical contact. That was amazing to me. I said, this woman is so still convinced that this man won't harm her, even with a gun out. Move, get out of the spot. Somebody starts saying something to you, you're in a parking spot, you're in a store, just leave. That's a part of minimizing contact, or at least minimizing the contact that's been made. I had to go to a dealership and clean my car out, and the suspected racist back there allowed the dust to go all over my seats. So I pulled into a park, or like a forest preserve parking spot, and a big truck came in, you know, like a pickup truck. And I thought, I need to pay attention to this truck. And when I did, as it turned in on the rear, there was a symbol. It looks like the letter D, but it has antlers on it. And I guess it's also because I do graphic design that I was able to understand what I saw. I must assume that any person that has that symbol, the Marine Corps symbol, any other Department of Defense symbol, NRA, that they are armed. You should suspect that regardless, but these people are brandishing that they're carrying. And we just need to be privy of that. We are behind enemy lines. I was out of town today helping a friend that's running for school board. We were canvassing the area. We got done, decided to drive back to a restaurant to debrief. On the way back, for about 2.5 miles on every corner, there were at least 3 to 4 squad cars to the left and to the right, north and south. And then there were unmarked cars spotted and peppered throughout parking spots. Sorry, that's a metaphor. They were spread out. And so I was with my son and this elder. And I said, I don't know what's going on, but we need to go to our respective locations, to our base. He said, yeah, I'm going to go pick up my grandkids now. I'm calling my son, telling them wherever you're at, stay where you're at. And whatever was going on in my understanding was either a drill or they were actually prepped for something to occur. These people were online. They were on station. There was EMS and firefighters all posted as well. So I called a friend of mine that was not too far away, and she has a small child. I said, I don't know what you're doing, but you need to get indoors right away. So I proceeded to go home. I got home. I let my friend know I made it home. And my other friend with the child called me and said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. Everything's fine. It's all clear where I'm at. But I just wanted you to know what was going on, because you have a child and you're out here defenseless. You don't have a man to help you. She said, oh, I just want to check on you because, you know, you come across paranoid sometimes. I said, you know, what's worse, being paranoid or being unprepared, sweetheart? Because here's the situation. I've been in the military. I know a military formation, even if it's the so-called police, when I see one. And I'm just trying to help you. So with all that said, I basically wanted to ask everyone, do you have a plan in place? Are you prepared if there is a catastrophic event? I know, given, you know, some things are going to be out of your hands, but what about the stuff that isn't? Are you able to practice proper self-defense? We're out here sitting ducks most of the time, engaging people who have murderous intent half the time for us and have proven it. And we want to have dialogues. It's one thing if somebody runs up on you and you don't suspect it or whatever. But we need to minimize contact, and we need to make sure if the contact's made and it's our life versus theirs, that we're able to defend ourselves to the best of our ability, even if it takes us out. It's serious. Things are serious. And as resources get depleted and more rich white racist white supremacists take from everyone else on the planet, you're going to see more and more weird things occur and more direct violence occur. And I say that with peace and love. So I will mute my line. Thank you, Gus. Oh, before I go, I do want to say I've been thinking about here and there your niece. I hope she's doing well, wherever she is. And I hope she's able to maintain her self-defense and practice the highest black self-respect, as you say. So thank you for that. I'll mute my line. Good night, everybody. Good night, Gus.
Much obliged, Irie. White people are definitely dangerous and frequently armed. That's another thing to keep in mind as well in those type of skirmishes and things out in public, that whites, race soldiers, badge or no, they brag about their firearms, to be mindful of that. Mr. Fuller, I think he would say in those sort of situations, he would encourage flee. If you engage, I would say even with the mace, because if you mace somebody, if they have a gun, they might decide I'm gonna shoot you. If once I get my vision back, you know, it's shooting time. So once you get to that situation, to I am ready to kill and or be killed. And, you know, once it gets to that, if you got your offspring there, then that would mean them too. That's why I said, you know, for me, if we can get to the car, we are out of here. It's nothing to discuss. Goodbye. And we'll just make sure to report him later. Folks that we have missed totally, if you have comment, questions, suggestions, proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. Lots of course, good clips. The one about limiting the white nationalists / white supremacists on Facebook, I actually disagree with that. We need to know who these people are to be able to identify them if they're in our neighborhoods or whatever, so we know, as the previous caller said, how to prepare against those people, because they can go on what's called, I guess, the dark web and do whatever they need to do there, then reemerge and attack. So I know, I guess, people's feelings may be hurt by what they say, but I think it is important to know who these people are, because the white people say, oh, I'm not a racist, so-and-so is a racist. Well, who's so-and-so? You know, this is a way to find out who those people are so we can prepare. And if white people are serious about ending racism, especially those quote-unquote good white people, you know, I guess that's an oxymoron, but those quote-unquote good white people, they should be ready to identify them and help everyone prepare themselves if they are these quote-unquote good white people. I'm really Jesse Smollett out. He said what he said, did what he did. He's not going to jail. How's the one in Flint? You know, I think there are more important things. I know there are, I guess, other implications, but, you know, calling it the worst thing that can happen, whitewash, that was classic. That was a classic line from Rahm Emanuel concerning the source of what he said. This is a whitewashing of justice. I laughed. I still laugh. But the gentleman who was talking about dealing with his grandmother, I would take the same strategy as you would deal with anyone. Continue to ask questions. You should vote. Well, who should I vote for? You know, if they don't have a name, you know, ask them for a recommend. You know, can just continue to ask. You know, ask, of course, in a more loving way, because there's your grandmother. I had a non-voting issue one time with my grandmother. She used to tell me I should tell my mother what to do. So one day I just asked her, I said, Grandma, when my mother tells you what to do, do you listen? She said no. So then I asked her, well, what makes you think my mother is going to listen to me tell her what to do when all three of us are just alike? It bought me a couple of months. You know, she wasn't upset, because I was talking to her over the phone. She wasn't upset. She was very calm. I asked her in a calm way, not the mean way, because I love my grandmother. She's passed away. But it was very calm. I just asked her. You know, she was a rational person, as I believe the gentleman's grandmother is a rational person. And she at least took a break from telling me she got to tell my mother what to do for a while. So it bought me some time. So in that case, there was really nothing much left to say. But in your case, especially with voting, you know, she may recommend somebody. Then you could say, well, I'll do research on that person and let it go. Or what issues should I be looking for if you really think voting is that important? And it may help you as well, because if you do the research, you may learn things that you didn't know, and you may be able to share them with her. So it can be a teachable moment for both of you. Thank you. That is all.
Everyone loves a teachable moment. I think that's a metaphor. Context of white supremacy. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I think the question that I asked about being most to blame, I don't think Mr. Smollett is most to blame in that situation, although I'm tired of hearing about that as well. I suspect, and especially given what Thomas in New York was saying, that someone classified as white or someone's planned, orchestrated, suggested is most to blame for all of that. Others that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. three pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Others we've not heard from.
Can I be heard?
Imhan DC, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Greetings. I am sorry to hear about the retreat being canceled. The retreat that I went to, the Cows retreat, was a very pleasant retreat. I had a good time. I was able to relax. I'm often very stressed, so it was good to be relaxed around people who were serious about ending white supremacy. I wanted to speak about, well, what the a few callers back speaking about military formation. So somewhat related, I went last year. I had gone to, it was nice. It was sunny out. Unlike today, it was not sunny. A lot of chemtrails, chemtrail clouds and chemtrail rain, chemical rain. But I went to the park last year, and it was a sunny day, and I was with my puppy. It was a young pit bull. I have a pit bull, a young female. And we were sitting at the park, and the ducks were in the pond. And I just sat and observed the ducks, and the ducks showed me military formation. It was beautiful. They showed me many things, but they showed me military formation. And just observing nature, I've been able to learn a lot. There's predictions. White people predict, they have estimates of how many species they are able to extinct in a given period of time. So they have, I don't know what the numbers are. I can't remember. But they say they have been able to extinct so many creatures, so many species of living things. And it's a continuous thing. So they say in the next hour, so many species will be extinct because of what white people are doing. I don't know if anybody knows what those numbers or what that rate is. And again, with reparations, I said it before, but it wasn't as clear as I'd like it. You cannot repair what is continuously, perpetually, presently being destroyed. You cannot repair what is being destroyed. It has to stop being destroyed first, and then you can do the repair. We can't have a reparation and white people still practice white supremacy. They have to stop white supremacy. Reparations will not stop white supremacy. Money, paper dollars, gold, silver will not stop white supremacy. We have to stop white people, the people. And that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, Imhan DC. Florida, December 27 through January 1, planned correctly. I wanted to make sure I saw my alma mater, Thomas Jefferson, University of Virginia, in the Final Four, March Madness, as they say. I am going to wager, I don't even watch college basketball, I'm going to wager Virginia will win and the Coon Man will be able to come out and celebrate a national championship with the UVA Cavaliers. Thomas Jefferson will be happy. Coon Man is happy. All is great in the Commonwealth. I am going to go at University of Virginia. They normally don't even get out of the first round. They are a tournament joke every year. And in the year of the Coon Man, they are in the Final Four. Wahoo wah. Other folks that we've missed completely, if you have commentary, proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, caller in Florida.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with the segment about the Facebook. I guess they were trying to do, or they did make official a ban on the, they were using a myriad of different terms, white supremacism, I think, and white separatism. I don't know if anybody else is listening to it, but they never gave a clear definition as to what the two terms meant, I guess. And it didn't really specify solid examples as to what constitute content of white separatism. And it seemed like they tried to mitigate the severity of racism by saying, we'll utilize the content of white separatism to mean that it can be inclusive. I don't know if they meant by just all kinds of people other than white people or whatever. They didn't seem to clarify too much about what they meant by white separatism. And it seemed like it was racism being practiced. And they said, well, Facebook, they kept using the term Facebook and not white people at Facebook, trying to use something that's not human and saying that they are being racist or something. And there, I think that might have been the same segment where I think that was a white woman that called up saying that, hey, well, what about black supremacists? Only just focus on that group. But it's like, hey, you don't have any major evidence of non-white groups with these substantial acts of violence all over the world like this on groups that are not in their group. So that's primarily where it's coming from, is the white collective. So, you know, she said that during the time of Martin Luther King, that he was nonviolent, but it was violent people, I guess, at that time that Dr. King was in conflict with. Like, she didn't go into details about what she meant about that. It was just something she just said, like, once again, finding ways to practice racism. And the I think that situation that happened in, is that Joliet, I believe. I think when I heard that word, that town, I believe it's in the Illinois area. I don't know if you remember the story where back in 2013, four white terrorists lured two black males into a home. And they strangled them, killed them, and had sex on top of the bodies. I think that was in that same area, Joliet, I believe. And that reminded me of that, more white terrorism. And my last one was the Jussie Smollett story. I heard that apparently, I don't know if the courthouse, maybe they sealed the case or something like that, where people couldn't get access to it. I thought that was suspicious, along with the guy saying that he couldn't get a response from the FBI. And one more thing, I thought of a term, I call it black epitomizing. I hadn't come up with a definition, but it was where that phenomenon where they try to promote a single individual black person as the primary example of an act of misconduct or a criminal act. R. Kelly or Michael Jackson, Chris Brown, when there's a hoard of evidence that pretty much produces evidence that is mainly among white men that do these kinds of acts. And that's all I have right now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Black epitomizing. New term. Love it. Counter-racism is all about creating new concepts to accurately describe, really, how individuals classified as white practice white supremacy. Black epitomizing. Outstanding. And with the caller, I thought that was significant as well, how she focused it black on the black nationalists, black supremacists? Why aren't they being subjected to the same sort of policing of their social media content? Thought that was important in that segment also. Are there folks we have totally missed who have commentary, questions that they would like to share? Anybody that we missed completely? Grant, if we got everybody. Other folks, if you had any additional comments, questions you would like to share, we have about 20 minutes before the broadcast concludes. Addicted to Whites, Dr. Jerome Fox should be here on Wednesday, I think. Hopefully I'll be totally recuperated by then. But Dr. Jerome Fox, Addicted to Whites, should be here Wednesday, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Other folks have questions, comments that they wanted to share?
Speaking of the state of Virginia, on YouTube, they have a channel called Vice TV, V-I-C-E. And it was an older episode that I watched it. And it had the guy who played Omar from The Wire with the slash on his face. And he went to a prison, a juvenile facility in Virginia. And during the discourse, you know, all black males in the young male in the juvenile facility. One brother, in there 3 years, he's 18, goes to the prison next year, real prison. But at 15, he was sentenced to 50 years, I mean, second degree murder. But nonetheless, during the course of the discourse he's having with the warrant of the prison, the warden rather, he says they're spending 200 something, I can't remember the number exactly, $200,000 per person they have in that juvenile facility. In the Khalif Browder documentary, it was $355,000, I believe, per juvenile on Rikers Island. And you talk about a system of injustice, like they'll complain about someone getting boosters or welfare, but they don't complain about them spending that much money just to house one person, like a young child in prison. Just how the system works. So, you know, I don't want to hear them talk about they don't have money. And that's what they're spending. I mean, you could have gave him a job and kept him off the streets for way less than $200,000 a year. I mute myself.
Dr. Welsing used to talk about that all the time. That race soldiers were willing to spend all that money caging black people. And this is a 15-year-old, as opposed to you could give them jobs doing anything, picking up litter, removing graffiti, anything that would be, you know, of some value. All that public infrastructure, don't they talk about that all the time? Get the Negros here. That'll be your job. We'll get all of our infrastructure, bridges updated, potholes, all of that. There we go. Now we got jobs. Things are better. That's not what they want. Other folks, if you have questions, comments, Draftomania, did you have additional question or comment? Let's see.
Yeah, I just wanted to answer a question that Anton DC asked in regards to the numbers of species that become extinct each year. I did research it real quick, and it says these experts calculate that between 0.1 and 0.1% of all species will become extinct each year. If the low estimate of the number of species out there is true, i.e. that there are around 2 million different species on our planet, then that means between 200 and 2,000 extinctions occur each year, every year. That's all I have.
Much obliged. Other folks, if you have comments, questions you would like to share, if we have any. Is there someone who had a comment that we're going to get in? Question?
Oh, yes. I apologize. I was closing the door. I believe, I don't want to mispronounce the Imhan Dissi, when he mentioned about watching the animals and everything, that, you know, the best people that have learned military strategy, you know, white supremacists, you know, yes, they learn from nature in a lot of ways. And yes, there's manuals that speak of birds in flight and other types of animals, you know, that they learn warfare tactics from. And the caller that just spoke, that door slammed, threw me off. But, the animals going extinct. I have a speculation that racist white supremacists feel that nature itself is something, because they can't control that. They're going to minimize as much of nature as possible as they can, including us, including other non-whites, but animals and plants. So they have maximum control over everything. And I do also suspect part of that approach is going to be the pushing of not just AI, but virtual and augmented reality. And people think that the Matrix is fake, but these people reveal their plans. They reveal it through what they call fiction, because as you said, and they admit, they are word masters. We have to really get our heads in the game. Things are going to change. And especially come 2020, we're going to see things that we've never seen as humankind before because of racism, white supremacy. I'll end my turn. Thank you very much.
Can I be heard? What the lady just said, very compelling, but what that's called is cybernetics. Cybernetics. That's that means navis in Latin, or govern, to govern. But it's the total control of everything, both man and machine. And since the 1940s, the government has been spending billions on sending the few scientists that was leading cutting edge of their field to meet and to discuss how they're going to create the system that we're in today, technology-wise. So look up cybernetics. That'll explain exactly where we are as far as that goes. And just off of nature, if you look at most of the military stuff they make, they name the planes after birds or insects. They name the Tiger tank from Germany or you know, Russia. I mean, they name their military vehicles after the natural things that they're supposed to attack like.
Much obliged, Thomason, New York. We have a little more than 10 minutes left in the broadcast. Folks have a thought they would like to share. 641-715-3640, the code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
Gus, are you going to take the offer for you to have, I believe, free classes?
I am working on what I think would be my own compensatory repair list for the gross manner of white supremacy that was practiced, which accountability. James Lowen talked about that in Sundown Towns. They purge all the niggers. And then purge all the evidence that they purged all the niggers. And the same type of thing could have happened here. So we want accountability and repair. So let's being truthful about what happened. They call that satya. That's one of the principles in yoga, truthfulness. So we should have lots of satya, truthfulness about the white supremacy racism that was practiced in a most fragrant, the word tacky, my God, has been, man, accountability, tacky, and repair. Those have been the words I have employed over and over and over. But accountability for the white tackiness and racism that was practiced, and then repair. And I mean accountability. Like, I don't even think that a complete acknowledgement of all of the different ways that white supremacy was practiced in this incident. So we would have to start there, and then we could move forward with the repair once we have an accurate acceptance. Accountability, there's the word, holding whites accountable. Acknowledging all of the racism that was practiced and then repairing the damage. Since this was a destructive, I told you words are important, just use that over and over. This was a, I've never heard a white person describe another white person being hired in that manner. A destructive hire. Going to use that again.
Did they make you mad or sad or discourage you? Like, what type of, I guess, emotions did they provoke? Like, how did they make you feel?
Just exhausted, because, you know, having to talk about all of this and writing it up. And I mean, it's just, I just wanted to practice yoga. That was supposed to be my mode to de-stress from the flood and terrorism and all that. And as I said, the yoga studio is on the plantation. So it certainly is a disgusting incident all the way through. But I think most of it, because of having a code, there were so many opportunities along the way where it was, you know, I've concluded that all whites are racist. I'm going to give them an opportunity to not be racist. But I am certainly waiting and prepared, but I'm going to give them a chance. And that's what made this so glaring, is that I gave them so many opportunities to not be racist and never took. And so now it just looks even more tacky and embarrassing. So it was really more just confirmation and opportunity to practice counter racism, you know. But I mean, hey, I go there to practice yoga. I go there to practice yoga, not counter racism. So it certainly has been a frustrating distraction trying to get my down dog on.
Oh, okay. Sorry for interrupting. Thanks for answering my question.
Other.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
So you're saying that the yoga studio hired this lady, Anna, to come into the studio to, what, terrorize you?
They hired Anna Brown.
Correct about that?
They hired Anna Brown Griswold to talk about racism. In her talk about racism, she practiced white supremacy racism against me in a very foul, flagrant manner during her hired lecture on racism. Again, all of these details will be explained, and hopefully we'll have Anna Brown Griswold on the program once again. But yes, she was hired by a different white woman to give a presentation in yoga teacher training, the class, the same, well, not the same, but 200-hour teacher training. That's what I did last summer. That's what this is. So she was hired to give a lecture on racism to a group of mostly white students in yoga teacher training about racism and why they shouldn't be racist as they go out to teach yoga.
Yeah, well, it doesn't sound like it's coincidence to me, because, like, if I'm not mistaken, this is the woman that came for the classes just while you're at the yoga studio, and it just doesn't sound right. It sounds like this is done intentionally, and I suspect it's been done intentionally. That's all.
On Anna Brown Griswold, I agree. I think it was done intentionally. I said the same thing this week. The white woman who did the hiring, and she said she did not know, and she was not present, which in my view is also an act of racism. So she didn't actually hear what the white woman's lecture was live. This lecture was allegedly recorded, so I am going to make a request to get a copy of the recording, if that is the case, so I can hear for myself. But, yeah, the white woman who did the hiring said she did not know what was going to be the content, or at least she did not know that, yeah, she didn't know what was going to be the content of said lecture. She'd heard her before, and, you know, there was no issue at that time, which, you know, that is a whole nother issue. But, yeah, I think Anna Brown Griswold, for sure, deliberate act of white supremacy, and that's the way I've explained it to other whites, and they followed the logic and agreed.
Well, I also suspect that they did now. I suspect that somebody may be listening to the program, know that you've had conversations with her, know that she's the reason that you were there, and that's why they hired her. That's my conclusion. That's all I have.
Much obliged. She is not the reason that I'm at this particular studio. I actually did my teacher training at a different facility. So, yeah, she's not exactly the reason that I'm at this particular yoga studio. But that's neither here nor there. Like, it's very small. White people network. Unjust networking. That was another new term that we got. Whites excel at unjust networking. So, you know, that is a kind of trivial point. Other folks, if you all had questions, suggestions, comments, we have about 5 minutes, a little less than 5 minutes.
My answer to your question from earlier in terms of who's most to blame, the people that hired her or her herself, my answer is both of them are equally to blame. It's just, This might be saved for when she comes on the program, but other than the fact that, well, shout out to the Codify software developer, because white people are going to be white. Other than the fact that she's white, do you know why she would, you know, attack you like this?
Oh, that was a question?
Yes.
Just to practice, right? I think that's just, you know, that's what whites do. It's Jane Elliott. I think we just had a discussion about Jane Elliott yesterday, another admitted racist, where this is what they get to do. They get to make lots of money to go out and give these lectures and hypocritically give the appearance that they are against racism while they are practicing white supremacy racism. So, and if it's, you know, in my view, if it's a black person specifically that they can abuse, whoopee. If it's black people in general, whoopee. But racism is being practiced. I'm being paid well for it. And I am spreading the confusion about how we should think about this problem, even thinking that there are some white people who, you know, are so-called well-meaning and working against this problem. I mean, that's what I was thinking. If they are so-called well-meaning, good white people, if they are at the yoga studio, well, then we are in trouble, man. Any other last
thing? I bet it was even more. Mm-hmm. I was just going to quickly say, I bet it was even more so that it was against the black male. I mute my line. Sorry about interrupting. I didn't mean to.
We will live. We will live. Any other comments, questions? Folks want to make sure they get in before we call it a broadcast. Again, we should be here. Dr. Jerome Fox, Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. I will say it right now. Anytime that I hear people that alter Mr. Fuller's quote, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else will confuse you. I don't mean like they're off by a word here or there or something of that nature, but like a wholesale change of the quote. That is something that I view with suspicion when it becomes anything that you do not comprehend will only cause strife in your understanding. Like, whoa, that is not quite what Mr. Fuller said. That always, and I've seen that a few times, anytime when I see people alter that statement, because, I mean, you could just quote him. Or not, you don't have to quote him at all. Like, you just say whatever you want to say. That is VGQ. He talks about that all the time. But anytime I see people change that sentence, because he says it so specifically all the time, it's the first page of his books, I look with suspicion. Any other comments?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. I was just thinking about there was a clip, I think it may have been a week or 2 weeks ago, about the terroristic racist shooting in New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a white woman on there that was saying, well, as a solution, we all got to come to an understanding, or we got to just, she used that come together type of rhetoric. And it didn't really, once again, it didn't clarify anything, because the greatest part of the learning is in the essential core of the racist white culture and the kinds of socializing they have with each other. That's where they really come up with these ideas, and they have their code, but they do not display that, of course, with the non-white people. So they come about in all areas of activity, making it seem as though like they are pious and they are welcoming to all people, but that's not the case at all. And I'm very glad that this program and this platform exists. And thanks for continuing to do these programs, Gus.
Much obliged. Thank you for participating. You all contributing, that is hugely important. I think folks learn just as much from the callers, new to unjust networking, black epitomizing, essentializing, epitomizing, that was it, black epitomizing, the new terms, all of it. Super appreciated from all the folks investing your time, energy, insights into trying to solve the problem. Anybody else a quick comment, or folks satisfied?
How'd you catch up with Dr. Jerome Fox? I really tried to look up his email and all that. Or, excuse me, not catch up. How did you get in contact with him?
I think several listeners, when I mentioned we were attempting to, you know, maybe have him on the program, several folks, I think the same within the broadcast while we were still live, they had sent me an email with his email information. And then, you know, by the time the archives got out a few days later, I got several other emails with his email, and I think even one with a phone number. And he responded pretty quickly. So people were better sleuths than I.
Okay. And I agree with you that we learn a lot from the callers, and even the caller in Florida that you just mentioned about his unjust networking terms and things like that. That is so true. I'm so grateful for all the people who call in. I've learned so much. I'm in my line. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, ma'am. Gang, we should be here Thursday. Oh, excuse me, Wednesday. Sorry. Well, we will be here Thursday. Sundown Towns, James Lowen, suspected race soldier. But before that, Wednesday, Dr. Jerome Fox, addicted to whites. With that, much obliged for the folks participating. Again, Gus T, it was an exhausting week. I am hoping that I can say that, you know, I can give all the details, because I know it might sound a little odd. It's such a lengthy actor. I mean, it's like I said, it would be easier to just say, oh yeah, she called me a nigger or a coon or a spear chucker. But I mean, it's such a lengthy thing to explain, and then the response. So it would take a lot of time, and hopefully we can get her on the program to explain all of this. But I am hopeful that I can explain all of the tackiness, all of the terrorism in detail with Anna Brown Griswold to confirm and answer questions about her tacky acts of white terrorism. And then I say, and this is the counter-racist response. We will have much more to say about all of that as we proceed. In the meantime, if you have questions, guest suggestions, gripes, or just constructive info to share, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com, the Cows Florida Retreat, December 27th to January 1. I was nervous about California because I said, wow, it's kind of trying to organize in 30 days. I did not know the summer was that tough to organize. You do need to organize early. We are pretty early for December 27, January 1, yoga retreat to start 2020. Just talking about the abomination that might be in store for us for 2020. I said the whole goal of this, we can do a vision board in Florida, counter racist vision board for things that we want to achieve and work on, planning out a constructive year of counter racist strategies. More details to come for the Florida retreat at the end of the year. Stay tuned. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Dr. Welsing would certainly want us to be super sober as we go about our cosmic assignment of solving the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, driver or passenger. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. They are frequently armed and happy to engage in lethal violence with Negroes. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.